Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Monday morning, everybody. Welcome back. We're here till 5 a.m. And Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in a little bit later on and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski. Jim's a little under the weather, so he's not going to be joining us. So Eric and I will handle all the movies. We'll review the new movies and talk about the box office as well. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio right here on WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. And we are back. It's Monday morning. Let me say hello to my great producer, Dan Shigrew. Hi, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you?
All right, man. How about yourself?
I'm all right. How was your weekend?
It was good.
Yeah?
Dinner with friends, birthday party. Very nice celebration.
Okay, cool. And you've been following the football?
Have been following the football.
Things going the way they as planned?
Pretty much. It's some surprising aspects to it, but as Vic pointed out, one is facing two in both conferences, so it kind of leading this, towards what it naturally would be. So.
Right. Okay. All right. Vic is in the newsroom. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, sir.
Have you been enjoying the NFL?
Yeah, I did. I took in all the games this weekend, a little bit of each, so a lot of others, yeah. But yeah.
What else did you do this weekend?
I got an update on my son. Remember I told you
he was
out of 40 people in his weight class, he finished fourth.
Wow.
Not too shabby. However, I did learn a couple details.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that there's a varsity wrestling team in junior high school. Did you know this?
No.
So when I said my seventh grader just made the varsity wrestling team, that was what I was told, but it's not the varsity high school.
Okay.
Which makes a big difference. I think that's why we were all a little like, what? But
yeah.
It's the varsity at his junior high.
Varsity
still
at his junior high.
It's still great.
No, that's
and he
great.
Finished fourth out of 40 in his weight class, so really proud of him.
That's really great. Good for him. Good for him. I used to, you know, my friends, I had a bunch of friends who were on the wrestling team when I was in high school. And I remember that they would, this is the one thing that I remember, in order to make weight, a lot of my friends who were on the wrestling team would walk around and spit.
Yeah, they do a lot of crazy things to make weight, but at his age, he's not being asked to do any of that.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's good. But I mean, but I remember guys walking around with cups.
Yeah, it's very disciplined, sport.
Yeah.
Very, very, it takes a lot of discipline.
It does. Yeah. I wouldn't be able to do it. Well, anyway, congratulations to your son. That's
thanks,
awesome.
Nick.
All right, cool. So Vic is in the newsroom all morning, and Dan is producing, and I'm here. We're going to talk about 50 things that turn 50 in 2019. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and then right after this break, when we come back, Eric Childress will join us, and we will review all the new movies and tell you what's going on at the box office as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about things that are turning 50. This year in 2019, so we can all feel old, much more. Right now, though, we want to do the Monday morning movie reviews. You know, Jim Liskowski is under the weather, and he will not be joining us as he is taking over for Colin Suter. But Jim is sick this week, so it's just going to be me and Eric taking care of the movies. But we will review all the new movies, that's what we do every Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. I got a bunch of movies to talk about this week, and like I said, Jim's under the weather, but Eric is with us, and here is Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hey, man.
All right, so let's get started.
Okay.
Why don't you start with Angel?
Okay, Angel or The Angel or El Angel, it's a story of a real life serial killer, young boy who kind of started off, it's an Argentinian film, Argentinian serial killer by the name of Carlos Roberto Puig. And he was a teenager in Argentina, and he kind of started off just kind of doing petty crimes. A friend of his at school had a father who was basically kind of a career criminal, and did some jobs for him, and started to sort of develop a greater taste for whatever he could get away with. And all of a sudden, robberies and petty thievery kind of led into murders and whatever he could cover up with that. Based on a true story, we've seen, it's not the first movie we're going to be talking about tonight about a serial killer. These movies can tend to be, kind of interesting if you don't know the history of these of this guy. But there's really not a whole lot interesting about him. It's a competently made movie and all, but the character himself is not particularly that interesting. He's just another kind of jerky kid who, he's got a taste for something. The crimes themselves are not particularly that outrageous or interesting, and it just kind of just delves into kind of typical biopic tropes and things, eventually just, leading up to, where it's all headed and, how this guy eventually got caught. It's a watchable film, but not a particularly memorable one.
Okay. And it is available on Netflix if people are interested in seeing that one. All right, cool. All right. Well, why don't we just move on to the house that Jack built since
we
started with serial killers. Tell us about the house that Jack built.
Yeah, well, this is the latest from your favorite filmmaker, Lars von Trier.
Yeah.
And this movie, people might remember, premiered to some a lot of controversy at Cannes last year. It's a story of Matt Dillon plays a guy just named Jack, who, as the film begins, is telling his story to someone. We hear the off screen. It's sort of narrated. He's talking to someone named Verge, and he's basically telling a story about how he became a serial killer, and it all began with picking up a woman played by Uma Thurman, who in a scene that really kind of bugged me from the outset, he picks her up because she has a car problem, and gives her kind of the standard "don't worry, I'm not a serial killer" line, and then she proceeds for the next 5 to 10 minutes to basically say all the things he's doing wrong if he was a serial killer, and she becomes such a shrew that he hits her in the face with a tire jack and kills her, and thus beginning his illustrious road down multiple murders, as we see each incident, how it comes to fruition, a lot of it done with a lot of black humor. It verges between black humor and some really disgusting, disturbing things, one after the other. All also punctuated by him telling the story to this Verge character, and them debating about whether or not what he's doing can actually be construed as art. And this leads to a lot of philosophical discussions that weaves in old film clips, including many from von Trier's own filmography himself, whether or not, can all these things be tied into what, movies teach us, exactly who's feeding the beast kind of here. And that stuff gets real tiresome really, really quickly. As I started to allude to with Angel, movies about serial killers, can be usually one of two things. Usually can be very disturbing, or they can sometimes be kind of darkly humorous, kind of funny in a way, in a disturbing kind of way. But this movie can't really decide whether it wants to be Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer or American Psycho, and it just kind of blends those two things together, and it makes for a very frustrating, sometimes sickening experience. There are murders that he commits along the way, particularly the one involving Siobhan Fallon, that is rather humorous. There are others involving, one involving Riley Keough that is quite just awful to think about, and even one more so right in the middle of the film involving a mother and her two children. That's really awful. So, I mean, Matt Dillon is, I think, quite good in the film. You know, it's certainly one thing that can get you through a lot of the more disturbing bits in the film. Not that this is the first time we've seen him play a serial killer. I kept thinking of A Kiss Before Dying many, many times throughout the film. But then it does lead to a final 15 minutes that, even though you should be able to guess exactly who he's been talking through this entire film, the name also kind of gives it away if you're up on that sort of thing. The last 15 minutes of the movie are particularly kind of engrossing and really striking to behold. I almost wish that the entire film was set in this location, because the visuals of the climax of the film are really pretty tremendous. So it's kind of a mixed bag for me. I don't hate the film. I can't really quite recommend it. There are portions of it that I think are amusing, and you know, some of it was very well done. Dillon is very good, but overall, I can't quite give it my full endorsement.
Okay, and it is 2.5 hours long.
That too.
Yeah,
yeah. And I saw I didn't see the unrated cut either.
Okay. Did he make changes? Did Von Trier make changes after the?
Well, there was one that played at the Music Box, like at the end of December. That was like the full unrated cut.
Mm-hmm.
That was the can cut, and then there was one that was actually cut down for an R rating, I guess.
Oh, okay.
That's the one that I saw.
Okay, and it's still 2.5 hours. The cut you saw,
pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, I've grown real tired of Lars von Trier. His movies now have just become like endurance tests, you know. And I haven't seen this, and I don't really plan on seeing it either. But despite the fact that I really like Matt Dillon a lot, and mm-hmm. and I would imagine that he's probably very good in this because he can play this kind of role. But I've got no patience for von Trier at this point.
What was that? I mean, you liked Melancholia.
Yeah,
though,
I did.
You?
Yes, I did. I liked that. The Nymphomaniac movies. Those were terrible.
Yeah, well,
the Willem Dafoe and the other woman just like I didn't even care.
Antichrist.
I mean, geez. I mean, what are we doing here?
This is better than both of those.
Okay.
I would say, but the stuff, I mean, knowing you, you'd probably enjoy, at least half of the murder scenes,
uh-huh.
But the pontificating about the art of it all,
well,
and von Trier actually showing scenes from Melancholia and like Breaking the Waves and things like that.
Yeah,
it's just kind of like, oh god.
Well,
who do you think you are?
No, that, I mean the trailer was enough to I saw the trailer for this, and there was like a little sort of. I saw the trailer, and then I was looking around online, and there was like a little featurette on it. And that was all. That was pretty much. I got the whole gist of it. I got the whole gist of it just from that. So All right. Now, and that's the house that Jack built, which is out right now. All right. Well, why don't I tell you about The Dog's Way Home? Since
please do.
We can go from one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
A Dog's Way Home is the latest movie with somebody doing the voiceover of a dog and a dog going home. Now we've seen, there's a million of these things.
There are
that have been made over the years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Incredible Journey?
Homeward Bound. Yeah.
Those are all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Homeward Bound is that's probably the quintessential one. You know what I mean?
Right.
The Homeward Bound, because mm-hmm. you've got three animals, right? There were three, right? In Homeward Bound.
Yes.
Yeah, and they mm-hmm. all had they all provided voiceovers, and they all tried to make their way home. And it's not
that's
like
right.
this is not a new thing. I mean, this has been done a million times. Now,
mm-hmm.
my mom really wanted to see this movie. That's why we went. That's why we
sure.
went on Saturday. My mom's like, I really want to see it. I want to see it. And I'm like, oh god. So essentially, what happens is this: this guy is well, first of all, you're introduced to the dog first. The dog was raised by a bunch of cats that lived in a they live in this decrepit sort of like building where all the cats are there, and this dog is raised by these cats, and then animal control comes to try and grab all the cats and get rid of the cats, and all of a sudden this guy who's been feeding the cat, this guy who lives across the street with his mother, played by Ashley Judd, he is feeding the cats and taking care of the cats. His name is Lucas in the movie, and the actor's name is Jonah Howard King. And he's mm-hmm. living with his mother, played by Ashley Judd. They live across the street from the dilapidated house, and he takes care of these cats, these stray cats. When the evil guy who owns the building decides that they're just going to gut the building and kill all the cats, he wants to stop this guy from doing that, but he falls in love with the dog. The dog runs up to him immediately and jumps into his arms. And the dog is voiced by Bryce Dallas Howard. So that's the voice that you hear for the dog.
Okay.
Throughout the movie, talks about how much she loves, I love Lucas. And so then the dog is taken away from Lucas. And because of the whole building thing, and there's, for some reason, I'm not really sure why, but pit bulls, I guess, are illegal in Denver, according to this movie.
They have some illegality somewhere,
yeah.
So I think that's part possible.
So this dog is a pit bull, so they take him away from Lucas, and they take the dog away from him, and they put the dog away, and then the dog escapes, gets out, and is going to go across the country to get back to Lucas. So that's the adventure. Now, hang on, Eric. I know you're waiting on bated breath to find out what happens.
I am.
But why don't you hang on for a second? We're going to take a break. We got the news. When we come back, I'll let you know how the whole thing turns out. I mean, I don't know. You know, the title of the movie is A Dog's Way Home, so you might be able to figure it out. All right, anyway, we'll take a break for the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. We are here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Our friend Jim Leskowski is ill this morning, so he will not be joining us for the movie reviews. So Eric Childress and I are taking care of those. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about 50 things that turn 50 this year so that we can all feel old and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Eric Childress is with us. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, I was telling you about A Dog's Way Home before the break. And like I said, it's, you know, this is nothing new. The adventure of a dog away from his master, trying to get home, and this dog named Bella is voiced by Bryce Dallas Howard. And along the way, the dog has all kinds of adventures, which you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
Meets like a cougar in the middle of the wild, and they hang out together. They're being chased by wolves, has all kinds of adventures on how to eat, and how is this dog going to eat. He runs around with a pack of other dogs, learning lessons. And it's all done, with Bryce Dallas Howard being relatively annoying as the dog's voice. Now I will say this: Charles Martin Smith directed this movie, and Charles Martin Smith, a lot of people know as an actor. He was in American Graffiti. He was in Never Cry Wolf. He was in Starman, and he is also a director, and he's directed several movies, many of which are about animals. I didn't realize until I looked at his filmography that. That's kind of his specialty now. Is like doing these movies, is doing movies about animals and stuff. Like Dolphin Tale, he did the two Dolphin Tale movies. He did he's done a bunch of
Air Bud.
Air Bud. That's right. He directed Air Bud. And this seems to be his thing. He's worked a lot. You know, he's directed a lot of television and a lot of episodes of TV and things like that. This seems to be, when he's making movies, this seems to be the thing he does now. And there are wolves in this movie, which I thought was kind of cool because, you know, he was in Never Cry Wolf, which is a movie that I adore. I love Never Cry Wolf. I think it's such a great movie, and I think he's terrific in it. He was also in The Untouchables. I keep forgetting he's in
The
Untouchables, too. So he's all the way around. Now, I will say this. It's a well-made movie. This is a very specific kind of movie. It's a kid's movie. It's for kids. And the place was packed, by the way, when we went on Saturday. Theater was packed on a really crappy day, too, because we went out, it was Saturday afternoon when we went, and that was when it was like, you know, the wind was blowing at about 900 miles an hour, and it was snowing. It was really nasty, but the place was packed. So it's a well-made movie, and it hits all the right buttons. If you like these sort of, you know, these kind of adventure, these kids' adventure movies with animals, you know, having adventures, this hits all the right notes, and it does it well. And I cried at the end, because I'm just a wuss. And it's not by any stretch of the imagination a particularly a great movie. Like I said, Bryce Dallas Howard's voiceover gets a little bit shrill at times, and it's a little bit annoying. The dog is adorable, or whatever, how many dogs they used for this movie. Is really adorable, and like I said, it hits all the right notes, and the kids in the theater were all, you know, transfixed by it, and there were moments in the movie where you go, oh no, you know, you get scared for the dog, and it all works. The whole relationship between the dog and the cougar is corny and ridiculous, and according to this movie, the dog is away for 2.5 years, so this goes on for 2.5 years.
Oh my lord.
It goes on for 2.5 years. And I will say this, once the movie jumps into the dog's point of view, it does not stray from that. So, like, you never see, you know, the kid Lucas being upset that his dog is gone. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, it is, once the dog is, you know, is on its own, it's all from the dog's point of view, and you don't see the whole family again until, well, maybe at the end when they might be reunited. So it's all told from the dog's point of view. So in that regard, you know, it works. Now, as a kids movie, it's really entertaining. And like I said, the kids in the theater, it was packed with kids when we saw it. The kids in the theater really loved it. They all sort of like moaned when they were supposed to, and they clapped when they were supposed to, and you know, you could tell that they were engrossed and that they really liked the dog, and the dog again is adorable. And so, you know, this is a PG rated, perfectly suited movie for kids, and it hits all the right notes. And again, this is a movie that's been made 9,000 times before, and it'll probably be made 9,000 more times, and they'll probably all be directed by Charles Martin Smith,
right?
Because that seems to be his thing. But I'm recommending it for, you know, I mean, it, like I said, everything that it sets out to do, it achieves. So, I mean, it's an entertaining kids movie. My mom loved it, and it was exactly what, you know, we expected it to be. It was, you know, adventures with animals, and then you cry at the end. That's pretty much what it is. So, I'm recommending it. So that's a Dog's Way Home, and it's perfect for families and kids and all that stuff. So there you go. Okay, Eric, why don't you tell us about Replicas?
Oh boy. Okay. this is a new science fiction film starring Keanu Reeves as a bio engineer scientist guy that is working on putting human consciousness into robots. I don't want to get too much into the jargon of this movie. Let's just say he wants to put human consciousness into robots. Okay. As the movie begins, we see that is problematic. Robots don't respond, or human consciousness doesn't respond well when they realize that they're not in their human body. Keanu Reeves also has a family. His wife is played by Alice Eve, and they have a number of young children. And during a rainy drive one night, well, none of them make it. There's a big crash, none of them make it. And in sort of classic 1950s sci-fi style, he wants to basically bring them back. His partner, played by Thomas Middleditch, he also has some expert in cloning. So they decide to basically merge their technologies and bring the family back. But you know, when you bring the family back, in their actual bodies and stuff, and people are aware that they're dead. You kind of have to hide them off from the public. So that's part of the movie. There's also the later part of the movie is them, or at least the wife discovering that they might not be who they think they are, hilarity ensues, and I do mean hilarity, because it's a really stupid movie. Just the overview of it, but it's also a film like you go into this movie and you hear that plot description. I'm thinking that eventually, like the opening scene, things are just going to go bad. When people play God in movies, it usually tends to go bad for them. And the whole time I'm watching this movie, at least until this movie sort of revealed itself to where I think it was going, I kept thinking that this movie is going to turn into Godsend, or that stupid Robert De Niro Greg Kinnear movie from years ago.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really go there. Actually, like the villain of this movie, is not really Keanu Reeves, but the company that he works for. And I didn't expect, a science fiction movie about resurrection and cloning, and mad scientists to devolve into like proprietary law involving the company that they, that all of a sudden his family are like, products of theirs, and that becomes like the chief conflict in the movie. This is just of avoidable science fiction at all costs. It's not fun in any way. It offers nothing to any type of discussion that you would hope in even a half-witted science fiction concept like this. It's just dumb and bad and should have gone. I'm surprised it didn't go straight to video, frankly. I mean, this movie doesn't really have any place to be in theaters.
Yeah, I thought it was going to go straight to video. I saw a trailer for this thing a long time ago, and mm-hmm. and just assumed that it would go straight to VOD. I just didn't think we'd get a theatrical release. But Byron Allen, we can thank Byron Allen, and his Entertainment Village or whatever the hell.
I wish it was called Entertainment Village.
Entertainment Studios got a hold of this thing and got it a release, and a big release. It's in a bunch of theaters, and it's got a lot of press. They took out a lot of ads for this movie, and this is Z-grade sci-fi. And I love, how much I love Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
There are no ideas in this. Any kind of like interesting, because like sci-fi is it can be a really a great a great way to think about lot bigger ideas. You look at a movie like Blade Runner, where you can take this subject and like really go with it, and the idea here. About this guy who wants to bring his family back and use the technology to do that. That's an interesting idea. It's not like it's not been done before. Bringing dead people bringing dead people back is always a bad idea.
Yeah.
We got Pet Sematary. The remake of Pet Sematary is coming out in a couple of months, and that's essentially that's the whole core of what that's about. But none of that is explored in any way, and the science fiction itself in this movie is just stupid. It's just like it's a genre that could be rich with ideas and like if you can, but there's nothing going on here. The acting is bad. The story is just stupid. You don't care about anything that's happening. And the whole subplot about the company and everything is just completely distracting and has nothing to do with what the core of the movie should be about. It's just stupid.
Yeah. It's like the movie like started off like it wanted to be like the brain that wouldn't die, and they missed the opportunity to have Alice Eve's head just, on a plate for an hour and a half. And then it ended like the reshoots of Brainstorm. I mean, it's just so stupid and pointless, and I don't know where when this thing started production, where anyone thought this was going to go. This is a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, well, it seems like it's a movie that, you know, like as we've said now a couple of times, that it's like it's one of those movies that should have just went straight to VOD. You know, there's just no question about it. It feels that way. You know, I'm in the theater going, why did I pay to see this? You know, what is this? This should have been on, you know, this should be on at like 2 o'clock in the morning on cable. I mean,
somebody had to know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know where, it seems to me like a movie that's, it just feels like, and I don't know the history of this film or when it was shot or whatever, but it feels like a movie that sat on a shelf for a long time and then Byron Allen dusted it off and released it in theaters.
It was on the schedule like sometime last year, I believe.
Yeah.
And then it got pulled from the schedule. I think it was supposed to come out in August, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it got pulled from the schedule and then it just kind of like remained in limbo. And then I think I saw on Wikipedia that Entertainment Studios bought it in 2017. It like had some like special screening at Toronto or something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the schedule for Toronto, I promise you that.
Yeah.
But somebody saw it and was like, yeah, I'll put money into that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's terrible. So.
Yeah.
All right, Eric, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress is with us. We've got a couple more movies to review. Jim is sick this week, but he'll be back next week, stepping in again for Colin, who's taken some time away. Jim was too sick this morning to join us. When we get back, Eric and I will talk about a couple of more movies for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here, coming up at 5 o'clock is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and 6 o'clock the great Steve Cochran for your morning drive, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, Eric and I are handling the movies together this morning, talking about the new movies, and we'll also be talking about box office this week as well. Jim Liskowski is a little sick. He's under the weather, so he wasn't able to join us, but we are back, and we got a couple more movies to review, and then we will jump into the box office to tell you what were the winners and the losers at the box office this weekend. Let's welcome Eric back. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, tell us about The Upside.
Okay, well, this is a remake of the French film The Intouchables from 2011, I believe the movie came out. Huge hit in France, still like one of their all-time grossing films. And this remake stars Kevin Hart as a guy that criminal who has a son and an ex-wife that he can't support anymore, has to look for a job for parole purposes, and he has to prove that he's looking for a job. Otherwise, he's going to be in trouble again. So he goes through a number of places, basically, trying to get a job, but just trying to get their signatures. He goes to a large upscale residence, believing that he's going to be hired for cleaning services. But in fact, they're actually looking for someone to take care of a quadriplegic played by Bryan Cranston, a very rich quadriplegic. Nicole Kidman plays his business manager and his assistant, and when Kevin Hart interviews for the job, he doesn't really want it, but Bryan Cranston's character is very taken with him, and he also sees him as a possibility that things don't go right, as most likely they will not. He'd be the one person to either basically get him killed, so he kind of at the end of his ropes and wants to end his life. At the very least, will follow his orders to do not resuscitate him. But things don't quite go as planned, as the two basically kind of form a friendship through their time together, even though Kevin Hart is particularly bad at his job. But, he learns on the job, as you would hope someone taking care of someone in this situation, right? But their friendship develops, it's a movie of their relationship and how it goes forward. You know, plot-wise, there's not a lot for me to say about this film, because even while I was watching it, it's a movie that didn't seem to have, you know, any really stronger purpose than, you know, just sort of documenting this relationship between the two of them, which is full of a number of cliches. You know, the rich guy likes opera, Kevin Hart likes Aretha Franklin, and, you know, that he's going to loosen him up by, you know, giving him pot and, you know, taking him out for strolls and stuff like that. And it's just, it's full of a lot of serious cliches. Nicole Kidman is kind of saddled with the third wheel role in here. I'll get back to her in a second. And, you know, watching the film, it's not that anyone is particularly bad in the film. I think Kevin Hart is fine in the film. I think Bryan Cranston is fine in the film. But it never really gives you, other than, you know, a couple early moments in the film, doesn't really give you that sort of sense of what it's really like to take care of someone in this situation. And, you know, so their relationship, you know, has kind of a sitcom feel to it throughout. And, you know, this movie didn't quite get down to the level of The Bucket List for me, although it does fall into the category of movies that I like to call, you know, boy, it's nice to have money. You know, a lot of it, you know, reminded me of the South Park episode where Magic Johnson reveals that he beat AIDS because he got, you know, regular injections of cash. And that's what this movie kind of feels like, that, you know, that it might not be so bad to be in this situation if you have a lot of money and you have a lot of people that want to be around you and you can throw your money around a bit. And, you know, that message never really, you know, works for me. One thing I will say, though, is that Nicole Kidman, who is really saddled with a third-rate role here, but does some really terrific stuff in the back half of this movie. There are a couple scenes in the movie where just with body language and smiles and the way she acts around Bryan Cranston's character, that really, particularly the final scene between the two of them, that made me so wish that there was no Kevin Hart in this movie, and that it was just a story about the two of them. There's a subplot involving him writing letters to, you know, a pen pal that they've never met, they've never spoken on the phone, and, you know, of course Kevin Hart, you know, throws a monkey wrench into that by just trying to get, you know, calling her, you know, against, you know, his will, and trying to get them to hook up, and which leads to a very awkward scene. And there's something that Nicole Kidman brings to a couple of these scenes late in the film that I just, like, man, it would have been really interesting to see a real love affair break out between these two characters. I really wish the film had been about that, and not about this relationship that we've seen so many times before in different situations. I didn't hate the film, but I'm far from recommending it either.
Okay, hang on, Eric. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, I'll let you know what I thought of The Upside after we go to the news. And we'll be back after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, right up here, 18 floors above beautiful downtown Chicago. Jim Laskowski is out sick, but Eric Childress is here, and he and I are handling all the movies, and we are going to talk about box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, I liked it more than you did. We're talking about The Upside, by the way. Bryan Cranston, Kevin Hart, Nicole Kidman movie. I liked it more than you did. I actually think that the relationship between the two of these guys, although, you know, like you said, it's not like it's anything new. We've seen this kind of thing a bunch of times before. But I thought both of them were. I mean, I think this is Kevin Hart's best performance, maybe of any movie. Well, I don't know if that's saying much.
I wouldn't even disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's Kevin Hart's most, you know, layered work.
Although there are two funny things in the movie, you know, considering what he's been going through lately.
There's a
whole scene involving a catheter.
Yeah.
That is like, oh boy.
Yeah.
And there's another scene where he gives the "I'm just trying to make that a part of my past" speech.
Yeah.
There's like, oops.
Yeah, I know. The timing on this is a little weird right now because of what he's going through. But I also agree with you about Nicole Kidman. We're going to talk about Nicole Kidman in the next movie. Wow, yeah, we're going to talk about Nicole Kidman. A little bit different than what she does in this movie.
Yeah.
This does cover a lot of cliched stuff that's been done before, but I think it's solid. I think it's entertaining. I think, you know, all the performances, are good. The life lessons that we have here have been done a million times before. But, like the dog movie, it goes through the paces that you expect. And it does so, I think, entertainingly. I thought it was an entertaining movie. And it made a good amount of money over the weekend, right?
Yeah, no, it's kind of surprisingly well. It's not a gigantic amount, but for what people expected it to do, I think it's a win for them.
Yeah, we'll go through the box office, but it unseated Aquaman as the number one movie in the country. But
yeah.
I think both of the main performances are really good. You know, Bryan Cranston, he's great, and you know he's always just he's always good. Even when he was Tim Watley, he was good. I liked it. You're not going to see anything new. They didn't, you know, reinvent the wheel here or anything. It's been, you know, we've all seen these kind of things before. But it's sort of like comfort food. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're going to get. You know, like people who went to see it over the weekend. You know, I think they went in thinking that they were going to get what they got, and they did. That's basically
it. I will admit, I mean, I kind of went into this with a little bit of that bucket list baggage that I have with that movie, because I think that movie is the most evil film ever made for the cash reasons that I refer to. So I kept waiting for moments that were going to elevate it, and it was the whole movie was kind of mostly on an even keel for me, where it didn't really, you know, rise or lower above a certain threshold. Although I will say there's one scene that really bothered me. If the scene wasn't in the movie, I would have probably been a little bit more, you know, pleasurable towards it. And anytime, whether it's real life or in movies, scenes that drive me nuts are moments where characters get so angry that they just wreck everything around them.
Yeah.
Because you never see the scene where they have to clean up everything.
Right.
Okay. And in this movie, you have a rich guy that can't move and gets so angry that he has Kevin Hart destroy everything for him.
Right.
That scene really angered me. That scene really bothered me, because he's throwing around a lot of rich stuff in that scene.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, that was the best they could come up with. That scene really rubbed me the wrong way.
Ultimately, it's played for a laugh. You know, like
laugh. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it's
hilarious.
Yeah, I didn't think it was hilarious, but it was.
That's
why it's in the movie. It's in the movie, so that, you know, for just one purpose, and it's to get a cheap laugh. But All right. Well, I'm recommending it.
Okay.
So, all right, Eric, tell us about speaking to Nicole Kidman. Tell us about Destroyer.
Okay. Well, this is the new film from Karen Kusama, and Nicole Kidman plays a police detective in the film, and as the film opens, she comes up to a crime scene. Body is dead in the reservoir. The movie's set in Los Angeles?
Yeah,
in the Los Angeles reservoir, and the cops see it thing as John Doe, but she claims that she can actually identify the body, and so she goes back to the department, and she actually receives a package containing a large dollar bill with what appears to be dye pack imposed on it. And she surmises that the leader of this gang of criminals is back on the streets, that he has resurfaced. And the movie then takes us through. She goes through different members, associates of his, trying to find out exactly where he is so she can bring him to justice. On top of that, we then flash back to a period in her life where we discover that she was actually undercover for some time, involving this criminal. She was a part of her gang. She had a fellow police detective played by Sebastian Stan, who was her partner and was also undercover with her. And they developed a relationship along the way under the stressful situation. And then the movie kind of goes back and forth between the past and the present, seeing exactly how all of these events are going to converge. Okay, so the convergence of everything that happens in this movie, to me, is actually kind of the least interesting aspect of it. I didn't feel that, because of the way the movie is structured, I didn't quite feel I didn't know if all of that worked. I didn't quite feel the necessary impact of as far as the plotting is concerned of this movie. However, the thing that does get you to feel everything in the movie is Nicole Kidman, who is, I mean, she is just, she is the echelon. She is up there with the best of the best right now. And, this is a performance that, she's in the present scenes, she's very glammed down. I mean, there's a lot of makeup on her. I mean, she's basically halfway to where Charlize Theron was for Monster. I think that was almost kind of the look that they wanted to give her, in a way, just maybe not without the weight aspect of that. And her performance in the movie is terrific. Is everything that she does in all aspects of the film, the present and the past, really kind of gets you into where the story is going. The plotting and stuff didn't do much for me, but watching her navigate all this stuff and watching the choices that she is ultimately making that all eventually come together by the end of the movie does result in something that you can walk away from. And I don't think this is a great movie by any stretch. And I also got to say that one of the gang members, or one of the criminals in the film, is played by Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black. I didn't even know it was her until the end credits.
Yeah, no,
of the
me
movie.
Too. Me too.
Yeah, I was just like, what?
Yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
So she's so watching their scenes together, when I watched it the second time, I was just like, man, it's like two, like the best actresses working today doing their thing. I'm not going crazy over this movie. I'm going crazy over her performance, Kidman's performance, and Maslany's as well. I think other people will probably respond to the structure of the movie a bit more than I did. The reason to see this movie is Nicole Kidman.
Okay, hang on, okay, Eric?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric's going to hang on, and we'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Destroyer, Nicole Kidman's new film, right after we take this break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and my main man Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk about things that turn 50 this year so that we can all feel a little bit older. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Jim Liskowski is sick, so Eric Childress and I are handling the movie reviews. And before the break, Eric told us all about the movie Destroyer with Nicole Kidman. And welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay. I pretty much agree 100% with you. I don't think this is a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but my God, Nicole Kidman is good in it. She's fantastic in it. It's a great performance. And again, everybody is talking about how, physically she, she's so transformed. Like when I first saw the trailer for this thing, I was like, what?
Yeah.
Cause I mean, she's one of the most glamorous women you know, on the planet. And
yes.
And to, you know, for the first time you see her in this movie, it's just, it's really shocking. But it's more than just, you know, she lives up to you know, like everybody's like, oh, look how different she looks in this movie and how you know, like not beautiful and really, you know, transformative. But she, it's not just the look. It's not, because I'm not a fan of Charlize Theron in Monster. And I don't think there's much of a performance there besides, you know, how she transformed herself from being glamorous and not being glamorous. But Nicole Kidman does in this movie. She's there 100%. You know, it's not just the physical stuff. Like, dude, this is a really great performance. And there are a lot of scenes in this movie where she goes, you know, she goes there. You know what I mean? And like, there's a lot of shocking stuff in this movie, and you know, you're unlikely to see an actress like Nicole Kidman do the kind of stuff that she does in this movie. And I didn't know it was her either. Tatiana Maslany, I didn't know it was her either.
Right.
I mean, but she's one of those. She's another one of those actresses that, like, you know, she really does. I mean, well, she, you know, in Orphan Black, she played 900 different roles.
Yeah.
On that show. So she is one of those actresses that you can't recognize. She's really, seriously, like, I've seen her on talk shows and I'm like, oh, that's what she looks like? For real? because she's so, you know, physically different in everything that she does. And I didn't know, and like you, Eric, I was like, wait a minute, that was her?
Yeah.
I felt the same way. There's a lot of really, you know, like the flashback structure doesn't necessarily work, but what really knocks this thing out of the park 100% is, like you said, is Nicole Kidman. She's great. She's really, really great, and I'm recommending people see it just because of her. And I think, you know, I agree with you 100% on this. She's phenomenal in this movie. It's a great performance.
Yeah, so, I think it's weird when, you know, just hearing us talk about it, that she's not more in the running for Best Actress.
Yeah. I know. I know. It's crazy. I mean, she did get the Golden Globe nomination,
right,
for Destroyer,
right?
And
not much else.
No, and I think she's getting and there's consideration for supporting actress for Boy Erased. I know that she was.
Yeah, like, that's not gonna happen either.
Last night, the Critics' Choice Awards were given out, and she was nominated for that. But I don't see that happening either.
Okay.
But she's great in Destroyer. It's a great performance.
Yep.
All right, Eric, one more movie to talk about, and then box office. Tell us about Stan and Ollie.
Okay. Well, if the title doesn't clue you off, this is the story about Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. It's a film that takes place basically at the end of their very, very long partnership. The film opens with a bit telling us about how popular they were back in the 1930s and explain how Stan, played by Steve Coogan, got into payment disputes with Hal Roach, and you know, basically sort of dissolved their contract until you know, Oliver had to, you know, go it alone, at least on one movie, and that has kind of not sit well with Stan for a couple of decades, even though he mostly keeps it to himself. Flash forward to the 1950s when Stan claims he is trying to get, the two of them are working together on an idea for a new comedic take on Robin Hood. So while they're working on that script, Stan keeps telling them that he's you know, trying to get the funding for it, though it's run into more than a few snags. And while they do that, they're going to do some live stage shows in the United Kingdom and Ireland, you know, basically try to boost their popularity, which doesn't go well at first, plays to a lot of empty houses. But as they begin making public appearances, the publicity pays off, and they start you know, filling houses again with doing a lot of their old routines just on the live stage. But you know, the issues with their partnership come to fruition at one point, and kind of fractures them off, you know, until they can get together again and everything is all happy and, you know, blah, blah. Okay, so I was trying to think, you know, just, you know, even just now, if how many theatrical tales of Oliver and, you know, Stan and Ollie there have been over the years. Can you think of any other theatrical versions, Nick, where biopics?
Of Laurel and Hardy?
Yeah.
There was a TV movie. This is the only thing I can think of. There was a TV movie from, I want to say the 80s, and I can't remember who starred in it.
Yeah, that's the one I kept thinking of. So it's kind of remarkable that there's never been a story about these guys.
Yeah.
I'm probably not as much on my history with them as maybe you are, primarily because, you know, of all of the comedians of that era, and so all the ones that I studied and watched over and over again, they were always on the lower rung of, you know, the ones that I enjoyed. You know, every time I saw Laurel and Hardy films, I'd be like, you know, that's kind of cute, you know, but I'd never really developed this kind of rapport that I did with Chaplin and Keaton. Okay. And, you know.
Yeah, I'm just the opposite.
You're a big fan.
I love Laurel and Hardy, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So you probably have a little bit more invested in this movie than I did. Mm. And watching this movie, I kind of had the same reaction, that I'm watching the routines, I'm like, that's cute, that's kind of nice. And one of the things that the best thing obviously about this movie are the two performances. Particularly, I think Steve Coogan. I didn't mention John C. Reilly plays Oliver Hardy,
right?
But I think that Steve Coogan is particularly good as Laurel in the film. I think he gives the best. Reilly's getting all the acclaim for, you know, again, it's a lot of makeup, to transform him into that. But I think Coogan does a lot more nuanced work as Laurel. But going back to how I originally set that up, this is a film that never really gets into why their popularity kind of waned. You know, it kind of, you know, it goes from their highest point to their lowest point, but never really factors in. You know, there's one shot where they, you know, Stan passes a poster of Abbott and Costello, and we're supposed to go like, oh, the new kids on the block, that's why they're not popular anymore. But, you know, all the comedians, you know, that I mentioned, you know, I didn't even bring up W.C. Fields and everything, all these, you know, these widely popular characters from that time, the movie never really digs into that. And again, the partnership stuff in the film, I mean, we can go back to what we were just talking about, the upside is, you know, we've seen that kind of relationship, particularly in showbiz, play itself out exactly the way it plays out in this movie. And I felt that the film just kind of missed so many opportunities to grant further insight into just their comedy, just their, some of the better scenes of the movie are where I think they're actually working on the Robin Hood script and kind of like tossing ideas back and forth. I thought that, you know, those scenes were really kind of nice. The backstage showbiz stuff is just really not that interesting. And while the two of them are pros and play very well off each other, I just didn't feel anything beyond the way I used to watch Laurel and Hardy movies, just like, yeah, that's kind of nice, but, you know, I'd rather go watch a better movie now.
Okay. All right, Eric, hang on. Eric Childress is going to hang on. We're going to take a break. Come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Stan and Ollie, and then we'll talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on 18th floor here above downtown Chicago. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and Jim Laskowski is under the weather, so he is not joining us. So Eric Childress and I have been taking care of the movies, and before the break, Eric was telling you about Stan and Ollie. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'll tell you what I thought of Stan and Ollie. I don't think it's a particularly good movie, and it's also not incredibly accurate in terms of what, you know, in terms of what they cover in this movie. So it's a pretty inaccurate study of what was happening. I thought it was an interesting idea to have the movie take place when it took place, like towards the end of their career.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that was actually pretty cool, that the idea, the structure of it was that they were going to, this is towards the end of their partnership, and all the years that they worked together Is that's part of the backstory of, you know, where they're going with it. And I thought it was kind of cool to have the movie told from that point of view towards the end of their partnership with a lot of years under their belts and stuff. But it like I said, it's not very historically accurate. And again, you know, as you've said, Eric, it kind of covers the same kind of territory that you see in your basic sort of biopics about, you know, stars. Mm-hmm. And their lives. So there's nothing really new here, but the two performances are great. I think John C. Reilly is great, and as you said, Steve Coogan is incredible in it. And they recreate the bits that Laurel and Hardy do perfectly. So they clearly did their homework here. And it's not just them recreating the bits that Laurel and Hardy did, but there's a real sense of chemistry between the two of them. Like, they really work well together, and they're both terrific actors. And so for me, I'm not necessarily recommending the movie, but man, they're both so good in it. I mean, it's just terrific performances from both of them. Danny Houston is going to play. Does he play villains all the time now? Is that like? And that's another thing. Like Hal Roach is really comes off as a jerk. In this movie, and I'm not really. Yeah. I know that it's kind of one sided in terms of what you know the point of view that this movie has. But,
yeah.
You know, but Danny Houston. I can't remember the last time Danny Houston didn't play a jerk. Was he a jerk? He was even a jerk, and he was a jerk in Children of Men too.
And if they would have followed the book, it would have been even more of a jerk.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah,
I'm trying. Yeah, that's going to keep me up all night now thinking about Danny Houston.
Anyway, but I will say this. I mean, it's not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but both of these guys are great in it. I think John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan. Tremendous, and they really do a good job. They bring a humanity to it. There's a great chemistry between the two of them. You can feel the history between them, and then on top of it, they really nail the routines that they do. Like, they really, you know, you could tell these guys really cared about these performances, and they did their homework, and it shows, because they're both really terrific in it. But I can't really go out of my way to recommend the movie. So
yeah, it seems to be a trend this week. A lot of really great performances and movies that we're kind of on the fence about.
Exactly. All right, let's go through the box office, shall we?
Yeah.
All right, number one movie of the week is The Upside with $19.5 million. Again, we talked a little bit earlier about that that outperformed what we thought it was going to do, right?
Yeah, no, I think everyone, including myself, had figured Aquaman was in for the fourth week, number one in a row.
Yeah.
And, I think, you know, this movie, you know, because what we didn't mention is that this movie actually had premiered at the Toronto Film Festival in 2017.
Right.
When it was handled by a little company run by Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
And so, like, a month after it premiered, all of that erupted, and they had to sell off all their movies, or shelve them, at least. And this was picked up by STX, and, you know, I mean, I don't think anyone had any great expectations for it, but... I think that this you have to say that this is part of the star power of Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
Because you know he was able to, you know, even with the troubles that he's been going to, maybe this is a reaction to that on top of it, that, you know, people went out to support him in some way. But you know, I mean, I don't think, you know, in a movie that, you know, it's kind of advertised as a comedy a little bit, but certainly not. You know, Wedding Ringer or, you know, Ride Along.
No. I mean,
Kevin Hart helps the quadruplet, you know, is not, you know, exactly, you know, ripe for, you know, huge chuckles.
I mean, he's not getting kicked in the nuts by Tiffany Haddish. That's, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that's the kind of stuff that you would normally expect, you know, in a Kevin Hart movie. You know, and I think the fact that, you know, Bryan Cranston adds a lot of, you know, a lot of weight to it. You know what I mean? Like, if you're Kevin Hart's in a movie with Bryan Cranston, it's like, oh, wait a minute.
Right.
Because normally he's with The Rock or, you know, somebody like that. But, you know, but this isn't like an actor, you know, like a guy who's like on Broadway right now playing, you know, Peter Finch's role in Network, you know, and getting amazing acclaim for it. So, So, but that's it. And of course, Nicole Kidman, too. So, you got Nicole Kidman, you got Bryan Cranston, and then Kevin Hart. Yeah. So that adds a lot of, you know,
That almost makes you think that the grosses would go down because people were just like, Kevin Hart's trying to be serious now.
Right.
Well, you know, we want him as the short. You know, the funniest scene in the movie to me is the first scene between Nicole Kidman and Kevin Hart.
Mm-hmm.
Just seeing, you know, how they tried to make him seem not as short.
Yeah.
That was funny to me.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, Aquaman, $17.2 million. That's up to $287 million in America. What's it doing world? It's at a billion worldwide already?
It has crossed the billion-dollar mark.
My God.
It is the first film in the current DC cinematic universe to reach $1 billion.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's now up there. I mean, the Nolan's Dark Knight movies are not considered part of this universe, obviously, because they have a new Batman. But it's the first DC property. I mean, Wonder Woman did not reach $1 billion. Huge numbers here, but it was only kind of matched internationally.
Yeah.
But, you know, Aquaman, $1 billion. 37th film ever to cross the billion-dollar mark worldwide.
Wow, that's ridiculous. Because it sucks.
Number
three, A Dog's Way Home, $11.3 million. I can tell you the crowd that I saw it with on Saturday loved it.
This is kind of right in the wheelhouse of live action, you know, animal films.
Right.
Not huge, not short. It'll have a decent kind of hold kind of thing, but is, you know, not going to set the world on fire.
Right. Okay. Number four, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. $9 million up to $147.7 million, and this is doing well considering, right?
Oh yeah, no, I mean the holds on this movie. I mean the word of mouth just keeps building on this thing. This movie is going to be headed somewhere in the $180 million range in the U.S., which is peanuts compared to obviously other movies, like Aquaman and other movies in the Marvel universe. But for an animated Spider-Man film that not a lot of people have put a lot of stock in early on, present company included.
You
cannot discount these numbers. They're very good.
Yeah. Number five, Escape Room, $8.9 million, $32.4 million total. So the new Saw movie is now called Escape. Escape Room.
That's right.
Because that's essentially
welcome to the new franchise. they cranked this thing out for like $9 million, and they went the full Blumhouse on it.
Yep.
And this thing's probably gonna get over close to around $50 million.
Wow.
So that's a hit.
Yep. And it's not called Saw, but it is.
Yeah.
Number six, Mary Poppins Returns, $7.2 million. This is to me seems like it's underperforming, right?
It is. Yeah, I mean, it was steady all through the holidays, and it was I thought this was going to be the biggest movie of the holiday. I really thought that this movie was going to just bridge all kinds of generations.
Yeah,
and Aquaman I think took a bit out of that.
Yeah,
to say the least. But it had been holding very steadily, throughout the holidays, and it took a much bigger drop this week than I expected it to. Now it looks like Spider-Man is going to make more than Mary Poppins.
Isn't that crazy?
And it's curious, just this weekend that Disney apparently had people dropping the news that they want to do more Mary Poppins movies.
Really?
And I'm just like, you better get this one into profit first there, Disney.
Yeah.
Because you're not there yet. You still need about another $100 million for this movie to get into profit. And I don't know if it's open everywhere overseas yet, but it's not there yet. And now it looks like it's probably not going to do $200 million here in the U.S.
That's crazy. I never would have expected that. Seriously. Number seven, Bumblebee, $6.7 million, $108 million. As far as Transformers movies go, this is underperforming, right?
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
I mean, that stupid Last Night movie with Mark Wahlberg, the last Transformers, the last Michael Bay one, that did $600 million worldwide.
Oh, my God.
This one's at around like 368, I think, is what it's at.
Mm.
And yet, funny enough, the best reviewed Transformers movie.
No question about it. No question.
It has a higher Rotten Tomato score than the last four Transformers movies combined.
Right. And yet, no one's going to see it.
Right.
Number eight, On the Basis of Sex, $6.2 million, $10 million total. That's about expected, correct?
Yeah, good jump for where they expanded this thing. You can't turn on the news. Ruth Bader Ginsburg somewhere in the news somewhere.
Yeah.
These days, so she's getting free publicity just for being herself.
But it's
decent. It's not going to make any awards dents in the next couple of weeks, but people will still go see it.
Number nine, The Mule, $5.5 million, $90 million for this movie, man.
Yeah, and it's gonna cross the $100 million mark.
Is that crazy? It'll
be the sixth film of Eastwood's career as a director to reach the $100 million mark.
That's amazing. I gotta say, it's amazing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Number 10 is Vice, $3.2 million, $35.9 million total. And is that that's not fully released, right? I mean, it's.
Oh, yeah, no, it's been fully released.
Oh, it is, okay.
Oh, yeah, no, it's been, since Christmas. It's been out in wide release.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, it's going to get a little bit of a awards bump in a couple of weeks.
Right.
But it's just about, it'll be out of the top 10 next week, obviously, when Glass opens.
Right.
That's kind of what I expected it to do. I didn't, think that, whatever the reviews are going to be on it, I don't think people want to see a lot of movies about politics.
Yeah.
Right now. And I think that the reason this one did as well as it has is because of the cast, obviously.
Yeah, clearly. All right. Well, there you go. Those are your top 10. Next week, obviously, Glass is going to be number one.
Glass is going to be huge. It's going to be huge. The Universal let the embargo drop on it earlier this week, and even the people who are normally have been a little soft on Shyamalan during this resurgence that he's had, they are not pleased with the film.
Yeah, no, it just looks terrible, but we'll see. So that's the big one next week. And all right, Eric, thanks, man. And we will talk
to you
next week, and we'll get Jim in here. He'll be up and ready to go next week.
Yes, he will.
All right, Eric, thanks, buddy.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress will be back next week. Jim Liskowski will be back next week for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and we'll do it all again then. All right, we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and much more. Phone number 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Also, check out our podcasts. Every second of the show is podcast. You can go to WGNradio.com, check that out. Go to iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe, it's free, and they will automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. All right, caught up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. All right, we are talking about things that are turning 50 in 2019. And some of these things are going to make you feel real old. But things that are turning 50. And we like to talk about these things here. So the first manned moon landing. Wow, 50 years. Apollo 11 began its historic voyage to the moon on July 16th, 1969. It reached its destination on July 20th, and on July 21st, Neil Armstrong became the first person to step on the lunar surface with Buzz Aldrin following him about 20 minutes later. The mission marked the beginning of the U.S. putting a dozen men on the moon. Wow, 50 years old. You think maybe, Dan, they should have, maybe it would have been more successful if they released first man this year?
It's an interesting thought, yeah.
On the 50th anniversary.
Right.
I mean... because I think, well, we've talked about this, how Universal really screwed up the release of that movie big time. Like, they just, I don't think they knew what they had. I don't think it was released at the right time, and I think Universal was more concerned about the movie Halloween, which, that was a big success, but First Man got, and as a result, I mean, it's going to get some, it's going to get some nominations. There's no question about it. I know Claire Foy is definitely going to be nominated for Supporting Actress. She seems to be the leaderboard. She's on the leaderboard for that. But maybe it would have been more of a success.
Yeah. Well, and you know, even if you do the whole just shown in L.A. and New York for 2 weeks in 2018
mm-hmm.
and then released it in 2019, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was you know, there's something to latch onto, 50th anniversary. I mean, that's something you could, that's another selling point. It is available now on DVD, though, and I think people, you know, if you've not seen First Man, it's a really great movie. It's too bad you didn't get to see it the way it was supposed to be seen. For me, IMAX. You got to see it in IMAX. So, but that's, I was four when they landed on the moon, and I very, very vaguely remember it. Obviously it was a big deal, but very vaguely remember it. Hey, we've talked about this before, Dan. What was the first big news story that you were aware of?
The first big news story that I was aware of, it was probably the Challenger.
Oh, sure.
I would have been in
86.
Yeah, so second grade, I believe, at that time.
That was 86, right?
Yes, I believe you're right. I'll double check. Yeah. But yeah, I remember definitely being in school and having that happen. And there was supposed to be, was supposed to be shown. I don't think we were watching the TV when it happened, but I remember the TV being in the room, and I remember the teachers like talking in hushed tones and a lot of like, how do we handle this? And just a lot of just, definitely it was just kind of like, this is the weirdest school day I've ever experienced. What's going on? That type of thing.
Yeah. I remember I was working at Jewel, when it happened, and, somebody was down in the break room downstairs, and I guess they had it because there was a small TV set in the basement in the break room, and I guess someone came up. I remember someone comes up. I'll tell you I was that morning I was working the generic aisle, which I've mentioned before was always the biggest pain in the butt to stock, because every type of package and food was in the generic aisle. But I remember I was working in the generic aisle, and somebody came up and said that the space shuttle just exploded, and we were like, what? And then we all kind of took a break and went downstairs and watched a little bit of on the news. Really unbelievable. Really, really sad. My first news memory was the Watergate hearings. That's what I remember. I just remember I didn't understand what was happening, obviously, but the Watergate hearings was the first big news story that I remember as a kid, because it was all encompassing. It was on every day. Like the hearings were on every single day. And, I remember, my mom's, soap opera and TV, schedule was completely screwed up, because now this went on for weeks, but that's the first thing that I remember. The first thing that I remember was Watergate. So, all right. Also turning 50 this year, Sesame Street. On November 10th, 1969, television audiences were introduced to Sesame Street. In nearly 50 years since, the series has become one of the television's most iconic programs. So they still, do your kids watch Sesame Street?
Here and there.
Yeah. But it's Elmo now, right? Like, he's the deal?
Yes, Elmo is definitely the main draw of the show.
You better not talk to Dan Feinberg about that.
Right.
Because
he's a Grover guy in an Elmo world.
Yeah, he hates Elmo. I was like, whoa, Dan, wow. Because he went off on Elmo that time. 50 years, Sesame Street. From 1969. Of course, I watched that when I was a kid all the time. How about this? The Stonewall Riots. In the early morning hours, June 28, 1969, the Stonewall Inn, a popular gay bar in New York City's West Village, was raided by police. The incident sparked a series of riots and protests and became the birthplace of the modern LGBTQ rights movement. In 2016, the bar was named a national monument. All right. Wow, how about this? Turning 50 this year, Monty Python's Flying Circus. Wow. October 5th, 1969, Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, Michael Palin, and Terry Gilliam changed the face of sketch comedy forever with the BBC debut of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Yeah. Wow, 50 years. You know, it's crazy because I remember I started watching Monty Python's Flying Circus like in the mid-70s. Something like that, 75 maybe, 76. No, earlier than that. It had to be earlier than that. Because, it had to be earlier than that because Holy Grail came out in 75? Did Holy Grail come out? Dan, can you look up Monty Python and Holy Grail, what year that came out? Because by the time Holy Grail came out, I had been watching Python for a long time.
Released
in 75. Okay, so then I started watching it. Man, I started watching Python at least a year and a half before that. So like 74, I started watching Python. But I told you, my dad made me watch it because I was laughing at Welcome Back, Kotter. I started laughing at Welcome Back, Kotter. And my dad is like, what are you doing? My dad could not believe that I was laughing at Welcome Back, Kotter. So he's like, listen, Sunday night, we're going to turn on channel 11 and you'll see something funny, like real funny.
Quickly, before we have to break, Ernie, our engineer, popped his head in and his dad made him watch Monty Python and Fawlty Towers as well.
Ah, there you go. Those are good dads. Yeah, because my dad was just appalled that I was laughing at Welcome Back, Kotter. My dad was like, what the hell is wrong with you? And so he turned me on to Python. Which, of course, led to all the British comedies that, you know, all the British comedy. And then, of course, Fawlty Towers, one of the greatest shows of all time. So, all right, cool. Let's take a break here and we'll come back. We got the news coming up after this. Oh, yeah. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you want to jump in. We're talking about things that are turning 50 in 2019. Actually, you know, Dan, something that's turning 40 is the Blizzard of 79, which I believe began today, if I'm not mistaken, or yesterday. And that was, that was crazy. I remember, I remember walking down the middle of Lincoln Avenue, because everything else was just, the snow was piled everywhere. You couldn't even walk. You had to walk in the street. And it was horrendous. I mean, it was ridiculous. But that was when, you know, this is when we were living on Addison and right next to the L tracks. And so there was a mobile gas station on the other side of the L tracks, which is now condos over there at Addison and Ravenswood. And this mobile gas station next door got snow plows and they plowed out the gas station in the lot and everything. And then they dumped all the snow under the L tracks right next to my house. And so that became like our mountain of snow. Like, so we would get our sleds and slide down and end up like we actually would slide off this mountain of snow, like onto Addison. Like we would fly right onto Addison. Not real safe, but it was the 70s. So, you know, but, and it was so high, the snow was so high that you could actually touch the bottom of the L tracks.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And it was there for a long time, but the snow was so, I mean, it was just crazy. We were out of school. You know, we had school days, and we very rarely had snow days. When I was a kid, you know, it was like, go to school. You know, you know, nowadays you get a lot of, you know, you get snow days if it gets a little nasty out there, they give the kids a snow day. Not when I was a kid, man. When I was a kid, it was like, go to school. It could be 95 below with 55 inches of snow on the ground and you're going to school. But we had snow days because it was so crazy. And that was, if I'm not mistaken, that's basically the reason why Blandick lost to Mayor Byrne. Because, you know, here's the thing. you're not going to get you are not going to be elected mayor if you don't clean the streets so that Chicagoans can, you know, get to work. And that's what happened to Blandick. I mean, the streets were a mess. I mean, for days and days. I mean, the plows were not. It was just ridiculous. You know how it gets when there's no plowing. Well, imagine that. I mean, you weren't even alive then in 79.
I wasn't. No.
But it was. I mean, it was. You know, and if you don't plow the streets, you will not be mayor. And that's how Blandick lost. That's how, you know, it was like, okay, mayor. Okay, well, Jane Byrne. I think she ran on the platform. It's like, I will clean the streets. That was the. I mean, that was like the number one thing. You don't worry about the budget. Don't worry about any of this other stuff. Don't worry about jobs. You know, don't worry about any of that stuff. Clean the streets, plow the streets, and you can be mayor. But yeah, no, it was really, really crazy. I mean, yeah. And I guess 68 there was another insane snowstorm in 68 that I barely remember. Yeah, and then there was that Groundhog Day 2011. Oh my God, was that insane? The thunder, snow, and all that nonsense. Crazy. But yeah. So also 50 years. How is this possible? The internet is 50 years old? What? Here's what they say. There's been a long-running debate about when the internet was born, with many tech heads citing April 7th, 1969 as the web's official birth date. How is that possible? Wow. That's the day the first official request for comments, or RFC, was published, which included research proposals and ideas for the creation of true internet technology. Well, where would you see this?
So I reread that sentence like three or four times to try to like translate it.
Yeah.
And I wonder if like that was the first time somebody goes, okay, here's my idea. How do we make this happen? And that's what they're considering the birthday, as opposed to somebody actually going online and visiting a website.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it might have been, I don't know for that for sure, but like that's kind of what I read from that like it wasn't necessarily somebody going on and actually visiting a website, but like, here's this idea that I have where people could communicate.
Right.
You know.
Right. But still though, man, you know, that even that idea 50 years ago was something,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, sure.
Because the internet, you think, because, I mean, it wasn't really until the 90s when you know, people would go online or you know, the internet really took off. It wasn't really until the 90s when that happened. So just to have that kind of discussion or that kind of technology being thought of in 1969 is really crazy. I mean, if you think about it. So, all right. Also, 50 years. These are things that are 50, that are turning 50 in 2019. Woodstock, the Woodstock Festival. God, 50 years old. On August 15th, 1969, a 600-acre dairy farm in New York's Catskill Mountains became the site of one of the most defining music events in rock and roll history. Though Woodstock's organizers assured town officials that no more than 50,000 music lovers would show up, word spread fast, and the final tally ended up being closer to 400,000, almost 100 times the town of Bethel's year-round population of about 4,200. 400,000 people! Oh, man. So that was Woodstock 50 years ago. How about this? Flavor Ice is 50 years old. Those plastic tubes of frozen flavored sugar water seem to be part of everyone's childhood, and with good reason. Flavor Ice made its grocery store debut in 1969. Dan, were you a Flavor Ice kid?
I did enjoy the Flavor Ice. The girls currently love the Flavor Ice.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Do they really?
Yeah, we've had to try to keep it away from them because we don't know what it is compared to like popsicles, but we're not sure that they would be much better in terms of the sugar content.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure. If it's got to be, there's a lot of sugar in Flavor Ice, I would imagine, right?
I mean, that's our guess. Just, I mean, yeah. If you think of it as a snow cone in a tube, you see what snow cones are, and it's like,
right.
Yeah.
But you know, the other thing about that, about the flavor ice, was that the package was always like a turnoff for me. Like, I hated the plastic. I hated the, like, the suck on the end of the plastic thing.
Sure.
It was never real. I mean, I liked flavor ice. I was fine with it, but I didn't go nuts over it because of the, you know, I mean, I liked the actual, you know, the ice itself, you know. I just did not like the package that it came in and how you had to eat it. I was always uncomfortable with that. I don't know why. It was just the plastic thing turned me off. So that's flavor ice. And I never really understood why they spelled it the way they spelled it. You ever think about that, Dan? Capital FLA dash capital VOR dash capital ICE.
Yeah, that is strange.
Yeah. I guess they just wanted it to stand out and be different, right? Yeah. How about this? The Gap is 50 years old. August 21st, 1969, Donald and Doris Fisher opened the very first Gap store in San Francisco's Ocean Avenue. While jeans were a main attraction, the retailer looked a lot different back then. It sold Levi's only and records in an attempt to attract the coveted teenage demographic. Records? I didn't know that. I wonder when they stopped selling records. Yeah, the Gap. All right, how about this? The Beatles rooftop concert, 50 years old. January 30th, 1969, right around lunchtime, the Beatles made their way to the rooftop of the Apple Corps building, Corporation building, their record label's headquarters, for an unannounced performance. It was the first time in more than 2 years that the band had performed live, and they didn't miss a beat. The Fab Four spent 42 minutes testing new material art on a crowd of onlookers. Eventually, a bank manager called the police to lodge a noise complaint, and the plug was pulled. Boy, what a buzzkill. Who would complain about the Beatles playing? You know what I mean? It's the Beatles, and they're playing for free. It's like the biggest band in the world. They haven't played live in 2 years, and some bank manager is going to complain? Come on. So, yeah, that must have been. But how weird would that have been, though? You know what I mean? To, like, you're walking around. I mean, well, you've seen it. You see it in Let It Be. You know, just the footage of people just like, what? You know, because it's like lunchtime on, like, a Tuesday or something. And all of a sudden, the Beatles are up on the roof, and you're like, huh? What? So. All right, here's another thing that's turning 50 this year. PBS turns 50. I think that's really kind of interesting that PBS and Monty Python both turned 50. Both turned 50 the same year, considering that PBS is responsible for showing, you know, Python, at least in America. We got to see it on PBS. November 3rd, 1969. PBS was founded as a successor to National Education Television and quickly became the country's preeminent broadcaster of educational and cultured television. Among its most popular series in those days were Sesame Street, which also turned 50. Wow! Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Nova, The French Chef with Julia Child, and Masterpiece Theater. And no mention of Python? Come on now. Nova. Is Nova still on?
I believe it is.
It is, isn't it? All right. 50 years ago.
Yes, it is.
It's still on. Nova's still on. Okay. Is it on PBS or is it on...
Still on PBS.
Still on PBS. Wow. Wendy's was founded 50 years ago by Dave Thomas in Columbus, Ohio on November 15th, 1969. The restaurant differentiated itself from the competition with its square burger patties, which were inspired by Kewpies. Kewpies? K-E-W-P-E-E, apostrophe S. Kewpies, a burger joint in Thomas's hometown of Kalamazoo, Michigan. Oh, I didn't know that Dave Thomas was from Kalamazoo. Did you know that, Dan?
I did not.
Wow. Okay. All right, more stuff turning 50. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. That's what we're talking about here. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back with more right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We're talking about 50 things that turn 50 this year, some of which are making us feel old. So 312-981-7200. Wild Bill says 50 years ago was the great Cubs collapse with folks like Ernie Banks, Ron Santo, and Billy Williams on the team. Yeah. Yeah, the old 69 Cubs. 630 area code says the true World Wide Web started in 1993. Before that, you had to phone into and log into individual servers. 773 area code says last Saturday, January 11th, was the 50th anniversary of Joe Namath's Jets defeating Johnny Unitas' Baltimore Colts in the Super Bowl. Was that 50 years ago, really? When Joe Namath guaranteed that they were going to win this, they were going to win the Super Bowl. 847 area code says regarding the internet, the Department of Defense conceived of AARPANE, the precursor to the internet, 1958, 1966. The creation of the ARPANET began on October 29, 1969. The first message on ARPANET was sent. Okay. So it does date back that far then. Man, that's amazing. That's fascinating. All right, also turning 50 this year, The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Dan, do you know this book?
I do.
How do I not?
You might if you saw it. It's got a very unique, like, style to it.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, I am surprised considering what age you were when it debuted.
But, yeah.
I don't think it gained popularity until much later. But again, if you saw the cover, or if you saw the style of art that guy does, I think you'd recognize at least his work.
June 3rd, 1969, Eric Carle's The Very Hungry Caterpillar came into the world and made the tale of, well, a very hungry caterpillar that eats his way through the story and emerges as a butterfly, a staple of bedtime stories around the world. More than 30 million copies of the children's book had been sold since its original publication. 30 million copies. Wow. I don't think I ever had that book. Maybe I did and I don't remember. You know? I don't remember what the hell happened yesterday. I don't know what's going on. This makes me feel old. David Bowie's Space Oddity is 50 years old. My God. In the opening song on his second studio album that would become one of the artist's defining hits. It was released on July 11th, 1969, less than a week before Apollo 11 began its historic voyage to the moon. That's interesting timing. Yeah, again, that makes me feel really old. Space Oddity is 50 years old. Hey, Peter Dinklage turns 50 this year. On June 11, 1969, Peter Dinklage came bouncing into this world in Morristown, New Jersey. In 1991, he made his on-screen debut in Woody Allen's Shadows and Fog. Today, of course, he's best known as Tyrion Lannister, everyone's favorite character on Game of Thrones, and he's the series' real star. He's won a couple of Emmys for that. So Dinklage turns 50 this year. Oh, how about this? Funyuns. Oh, yeah. Funyuns turn 50. Dan, you like Funyuns?
Who doesn't like Funyuns?
God, I love Funyuns. So good. They look like an onion ring, but taste like an onion-flavored potato chip. Funyuns have been offering the best of both worlds since 1969. I think everybody can agree that Funyuns are good. I don't know anybody who doesn't like Funyuns. Why would you not like Funyuns? Because they're fun. They're onions, but fun. See? I think the guy who named, or the woman who named Funyuns, just needs to be promoted to sainthood. All right, how about this? The Brady Bunch turns 50. Here's the story of a lovely lady, her architect husband, three daughters, three stepsons, one housekeeper, a dog named Tiger, and one jinx of a cousin, all of whom came together to create one memorable blended family sitcom. The Brady Bunch made its premiere on September 26, 1969. And it was a popular show, obviously. You know, but it really didn't get the kind of cult popularity until the reruns in the 70s. You know, that's when it really started to take off, like in the mid to late 70s, the late 70s, when like Channel 32 would show it. It was on like after school or like 5 o'clock, like right before dinner, it would be on. And I think that's when it really started to take off, you know. And then when the Annoyance did the real live Brady Bunch, that's where Melanie Hutzel came from, because she does the, you know, obviously she does Jan Brady. And then that was just like sold out constantly, nonstop. And then they made the movies. They made the movies with Shelley Long and Gary Cole. Gary Cole, man, how great was Gary Cole? Gary Cole in those movies. Those movies are really funny. Both of those movies are really funny. And I went in with the lowest expectations possible, you know, because at that point I had grown really tired of the Brady Bunch by the time that thing came out, and the Annoyance Theater was running it into the ground, and I was like, oh, God. And I went in with really, really low expectations, and I laughed my butt off. And I got to say, I think the second one's even funnier than the first one. I think both movies are really funny, but I think the second one's better than the first one.
Quick Funyun fact update.
Uh-oh.
Funyuns were named by University of North Texas professor and copywriter Jim Albright. He did it after it was discovered the first choice of the name was Onyums.
Onyums?
Onyums. So playing on onions.
Onions, but yum.
Yep, Onyums. Onyums. Good choice, Jim.
Funyuns is a much better name. Nice job, professor. That's what you're earning your degree right there. I like this. A nice Funyun fact. Thanks, Dan.
No problem.
Can never have enough Funyun facts.
Nope.
Did you watch the Brady Bunch when you were growing up?
Not especially. You know, like you said, I mean, it was part of the rerun rotation, but just it wasn't ever anything I latched onto.
You know, it's funny because I watched it every day and I hate it, but I watched it every day. So, I mean, I've seen every episode, you know, a ton of times, and I know all the classic episodes and all that stuff. And I never liked it. I would just kind of sit there, and I never laughed at it. I don't think it's a particularly funny show at all. But I did watch it after school every day, you know, or like right before dinner. Every day I watched it on Channel 32. And I'm not sure why, because I'm an idiot, and I just have to have the TV on, and I have to be watching something. So. All right. All right, let's take a break. We got the news coming up. If you guys want to jump in here and stuff that's turning 50, 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, talking about things that are 50 years old this year. 50 years old. I'm 50. I'm Molly Shannon. By the way, Dan, I did look up The Very Hungry Caterpillar, and of course I've seen it. I just didn't recognize. As soon as I looked.
That's definitely not a name. You know, it's one of those where you definitely recognize the style, not necessarily the artist name associated with it.
Yeah. No, but I mean, I think I had it when I was a kid. I think I had the book when I was a kid. It's instantly recognizable, so. I didn't put two and two together. But yeah, that's it. That's the deal. So that's 50 years old too. Brady Bunch, 50 years old. How long was the Brady Bunch? How long did that show run? How many seasons was that? It had to be like 5 or 6, right?
5 seasons.
5 seasons. Then they added, of course, Oliver. They had to add the cute kid, the cousin Oliver. You know, Dan, the only time I legitimately laughed at the Brady Bunch, like thought it was funny, because I never laughed at it. I would, like I said, I watched it all the time. But I never like, it's not a funny show. The Brady Bunch is not funny. There's just nothing funny about it. But the only episode that I ever laughed at was the very last episode. The very last episode. And it was, Cousin Oliver was in it, was in the episode. And this is an episode that, this is really funny because Robert Reed, I don't know if you know any of the behind the scenes stuff about the Brady Bunch, but Robert Reed was always fighting with the writers because he knew the show was stupid. And was constantly, you know, trying to scrape whatever dignity he could muster from, you know, being on the show. And I mean, it was funny. I mean, he moaned a lot and caused a lot of problems. But he did all the stupid variety shows when they had like the Brady Bunch Variety Hour and they were singing and dancing, and he was always there. I don't know what. You know, I'm not really sure what he was trying to prove by being such a pain in the neck to Sherwood Schwartz and everybody, you know, associated with the show, causing all kinds of headaches to the people behind the scenes. And he was always complaining, and yet he still did all the stupid stuff that they did, even stuff that they had to get a different Jan because the actress who played Jan wouldn't do some of the stupid variety stuff. She wouldn't even. So they had to, you know, replace a couple of the kids during some of the incarnations of these stupid variety and song and, you know, albums and stuff that they released. But Robert Reed was right there, man. But anyway, this last episode, the only time I ever laughed at a Brady Bunch episode was the like I said, it was the very last episode. Robert Reed's not in it. He refused. He read the script and he refused to be in it because he thought it was so stupid, even by the standards of the Brady Bunch. He was like, I'm not. So he's not in the episode. There's nowhere to be found. There's no Mike Brady in the episode. The episode is where Bobby is trying to sell a hair tonic. Okay, so he's trying to. He's got a case of like hair tonic, and he's going to go door to door and sell it. And so Bobby's got hair tonic, and then Oliver, and I think Cindy. Are breeding rabbits or something? Because I know that there's like rabbits are in there and they're going to sell the rabbits or something. And then Bobby's got the hair tonic, and so he's not selling anything. Like his you know, he's not being able to push this hair tonic at all. So Greg, who's got like prom coming up, decides he's going to help out Mike. Bobby. He's going to help out Bobby by buying some hair tonic from him. To make him feel better, to make him feel like he's, you know. So he buys the hair tonic, and then Bobby puts the hair tonic on Greg's hair. You know, he's like, oh, yeah, go ahead, put it on the hair, and it turns his hair orange. And this is like 2 days before prom or something. And so so it turns his hair orange. The hair tonic turns his hair orange, and so Bobby freaks out, and then... Greg looks in the mirror and he sees that his hair is orange and he's got prom in like 2 days. So he starts chasing Bobby around the house and he's going to kill him. And then Carol has to separate the two of them. And the only time I laughed, I laughed because, he's like, Bobby says it could have been worse. Could have turned green about his hair. And then, Greg is like, oh yeah, that's great. Real comforting. And that's the only time I've ever legitimately laughed. And then he had to go to the beauty salon. Nobody, you know, he wanted to make sure that none of the guys saw him in the beauty salon because he had to get his hair colored back to normal in time for prom. And then they end up spilling the hair tonic on the rabbits, and then the rabbits turn orange and they become unique, so they're able to sell the rabbits now. And so that's as stupid as all that sounds, and it was unbelievably stupid. That's the only time I've ever laughed was when Greg's hair was orange. That's the only time I've ever laughed at the Brady Bunch. It was so stupid. All right. Also turning 50 this year, Slaughterhouse 5. On March 31st, 1969, Kurt Vonnegut published what is arguably his most popular work, Slaughterhouse 5, a semi-autobiographical novel based on his experiences as a POW during the Allied bombing of Dresden in 1945. You know, they did make a movie out of it, which is almost an impossible book to make a movie out of. There are certain books that, you know, are just difficult, if not impossible, to make into a movie. And it's actually not a bad movie. Slaughterhouse-Five is not a bad movie. It's just not the book. John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Bed-In hits 50 this year. On March 20th, 1969, one of the world's most famous couples, John Lennon and Yoko Ono, officially got hitched. Knowing that all eyes would be on them in the days following their wedding, they decided to book the presidential suite at the Amsterdam Hilton Hotel and stage a week-long bed-in to protest the Vietnam War and promote global peace. I can't believe that was 50 years ago. Well, how about this? The automatic teller machine. Wow. So I'm freaking out whenever there's technology that seems that old. I can't believe the A-Team is 50 years old. On September 2nd, 1969, the country's first ATM started shelling out cash to chemical bank customers in Rockville Center, New York. Remember when it was called when they were called Money Network? It was the first ATMs that I remember were called the Money Network. And then, of course, Cash Station. Remember when it was.
I do remember Cash Stations.
Yeah, Cash Station was the most popular one. And now, I mean, obviously, ATMs are all over the place, and they're not named anything but ATMs. But I remember Money Network. I specifically remember Money Network at the Woodfield Mall. That's the first time I remember seeing Money Network. But yeah, Cash Stations with the green sign. That was the big deal. Now it's just ATMs are everywhere. But I can't believe that's 50 years old. First ATM in Rockville Center, New York. All right, how about this? Also turning 50 this year, Cracker Barrel. Oh, look at that. September 19th, 1969, Dan W. Evans opened the first Cracker Barrel Old Country store in Lebanon, Tennessee, where made-from-scratch fare was always on the menu. Today, the restaurant chain operates more than 650 locations across 45 states. Cracker Barrel. I haven't been to a Cracker Barrel in a long time. Of course, I don't do a lot of driving on the highway. That's where you're gonna run into your Cracker Barrels. Do you know, Dan, what the closest Cracker Barrel? Because I know that they're usually right up they're like at Oasis and stuff, right?
Right, right, or you know, yeah, exactly, like
that kind of thing. Cracker Barrel's good though, man. I like that. I like that. I like Cracker Barrel. They got some good stuff in there. Also, 50 years old, if you can believe this, is the Chappaquiddick incident. Wow. In the late night hours of July 18th, 1969, Senator Ted Kennedy drove his car off of a one-lane bridge and into the water on Chappaquiddick Island, Massachusetts. While Kennedy was able to escape the vehicle, his passenger, 28-year-old Mary Jo Kopechne, a former staffer for Ted's late brother Bobby, was not. Instead of calling for help, Kennedy fled the scene and didn't report the incident for another 10 hours. Kennedy eventually pled guilty to leaving the scene of an accident and received a 2-month jail sentence, which was suspended. Though he remained an active politician for the rest of his life, the Chappaquiddick incident, as it became to be known, is often cited as the reason why Kennedy was never elected president. He ran unsuccessfully in 1980.
Closest Cracker Barrels are in Tinley Park in Naperville.
Chicago. There we go. Tinley Park in Naperville. All right, enjoy your Cracker Barrel, everybody. All right, let's take a break here for some weather, and then we'll come back and talk more about stuff that's turning 50 this year. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right. Hey, everybody, welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. As he does every Monday morning. That's coming up. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. We're talking about stuff that's turning 50 this year, making us all remember things and feel old. How about this? Also turning 50 this year, Tic Tacs. introduced in 1969 as refreshing mints, quote unquote. Tic Tacs have cornered the market on teeny tiny breath mints that make a fun shaking noise while resting in your pocket. Though orange and mint were the original flavors, dozens of new flavors have been added since, and the mints now sell more than in 100 countries. Yeah. How about this? Sweet Caroline, 50 years old. June 1969, Neil Diamond released Sweet Caroline, which he later explained had been inspired by Carolyn Kennedy. He even performed the tune at her 50th birthday. Whether you love the song or hate it, it endures, particularly as a theme song at sporting events. For more than 20 years, it's been played at Boston's Fenway Park during every Red Sox home game. So good, so good, so good. I guess, you know, you can't hate Sweet Caroline, right? Yeah. Dandy, you can't hate Sweet Caroline, right?
I don't think you can hate it.
I mean...
You might not like it, but...
Yeah.
You might get sick of it, but...
Yes.
Understand the appeal.
Steve texts in. By the way, if you want to jump in here, talk or text, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Steve says, combining two of your items, how about Joe Namath appearing on the Brady Bunch? Ah, it's true. Joe Namath was on the Brady Bunch. Some of the other celebrities that were on the Brady Bunch, obviously Davy Jones was on the Brady Bunch. If I'm not mistaken, I believe Don Drysdale was on the Brady Bunch. Do we have any other celebrity? Dan, do you remember any other celebrity? I think Davy Jones and Joe Namath are the two big ones. But I think other celebrities had starred on the Brady Bunch.
BradyWorld.com has quite a listing here, so I will have to get back to you on it.
BradyWorld.com?
Yes.
Wow. Somebody really runs that website, huh? Let's see. 630 area code says the 1969 Dodge Charger is turning 50. Oh, okay. 414 area code says there's a QP restaurant in Racine. Great hamburgers. Besides Lansing, Michigan, the other three are in Lima, Ohio, or Lima. Around 1940, there were 400 restaurants, but there are only five left of QP. Third Eye Blind Joe. Oh, wow. I haven't heard from Third Eye Blind Joe in a while. Joe, thanks for participating here. That last episode of the Brady Bunch is also the only episode where Cindy isn't wearing pigtails. Wow, I've never even caught that. So she's an adult in that episode. Didn't know that. Wow, good catch. Oh. All right. Hey, you know, Friends is on right now, as you know, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
And you know who turns 50 this year?
I do.
Jennifer Aniston. On February 11th, 1969, Jennifer Aniston was born in Sherman Oaks, California, to actors John Aniston and Nancy Dow. Though she rose to superstardom playing Rachel Green on Friends, her roles weren't always so glamorous. Her first gig is an uncredited role in 1987's Mac and Me. Wait, she's in Mac and Me? And she had a starring role in the awesomely terrible 1993 horror movie Leprechaun. Aniston shares her birthday with a host of other talented actresses who are turning 50 this year, including Cate Blanchett, Renee Zellweger, Jennifer Lopez, Catherine Zeta-Jones. Jennifer Lopez is only 50? Wow. I don't know. I thought she was older than that. Cate Blanchett turning 50. This just makes me feel old. I'm older than Cate Blanchett. I'm 3 years older than Cate Blanchett. Catherine Zeta-Jones is going to be turning 50, and she's married to Michael Douglas. What? Wow. I guess I really didn't know how huge a age difference there was. Because Michael Douglas is in his 70s, right? I mean, he's, you know, he's got to be like 72, 73. I mean, his dad's 102. Did you know that Kirk Douglas is 102 years old?
I did, yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. Michael Douglas is 74.
74 years old, man. Wow. Yeah, well, happy birthday to these ladies who are turning 50. Jennifer Aniston, by the way, does not look 50 at all. You know why? Aveeno.
That's right. Aveeno and
what's the hair
water
thing? What's the hair thing? She has also does a shampoo. Doesn't she do like a shampoo commercial? Because I know she's got the Aveeno for the skin. And you water, right? Was it vitamin water?
Smart water.
Smart water. Yes, you're right. Smart water. And then I know she's got like a hair thing too.
Living Proof shampoo.
Is that what it is?
According to this.
All right. That's all it is, man. Get some Aveeno and you'll look like you're 13 too. Let's see. How about this? Turning 50 this year. Easy Rider. Now that makes me feel really old. The seminal film of the late 60s counterculture and one of the films that kicked off the new Hollywood era of filmmaking, Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda's trippy road movie made its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival on May 12, 1969. And it feels that way. If you watch and listen, it's a terrific movie, it's groundbreaking and it was historical. But it's dated, man. I mean, it's so dated. Dan, have you seen Easy Rider?
I have, yes.
I mean, it's you know, historic, and it's, you know, an important film in history, but man, is it dated. Which I guess, you know, it did capture that time and place pretty perfectly. And it also inspired Albert Brooks to make Lost in America. So right there, it gets a pass because Albert Brooks made Lost in America because of Easy Rider. How about this? I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, originally published in 1969, the first in Maya Angelou's series of autobiographies, delves into her earliest years, beginning at age 3, when she and her brother were sent to live with her grandmother in Arkansas. It culminates with a teenaged Angelou. Giving birth to her son, Guy, at the age of 16. The book confirmed Angelou's status as one of America's most original and important voices and was nominated for a National Book Award in 1970. Never read that book. How about this one? Wow. A Boy Named Sue turns 50. February 24th, 1969, legendary singer Johnny Cash debuted A Boy Named Sue. If the title and lyrics seemed oddly whimsical for the man in black, it's because the tune was written by children's author and poet Shel Silverstein. That's a classic song. How about this? The Firebird Trans Am. The first generation of Pontiac's legendary muscle car began rolling off the assembly line in 1969 and continued being manufactured with tiny tweaks over the years until 2002. The vehicle earned an important place in pop culture thanks to starring roles in Smokey and the Bandit and Knight Rider. Yeah, the old Firebird. The old Trans Am. I had a Firebird. The thing about the Firebird, Dan, is that it's all hood and no trunk. You know what I mean? Like the hood mm-hmm. is like the hood is like 7 feet long, and then there's like no trunk. So when you first start to parallel park in a Firebird, it's really confusing. It's like you got a lot of room back there, not so much in the front. But I just remember I had that Firebird for a few years, that thing was in the shop all the time. That was the car that I spent the most money repairing was my Firebird. I got it used. It was a 77 Firebird. I got it used, and it was in the shop constantly. constantly. I was blowing tires left and right because the wheel alignment was off. So I remember one time I was on the Kennedy and I heard because the treads just came off of one of my tires and they were just, it was flipping and banging the bottom of the car and I kept driving on it. I would go to those, I would stop off at those storefront tire repair places, you know, like on Fullerton or something. That's what I would go. And you just give me a tire. I don't care. Yeah, that's the car I spent the most money on. Although I did spend a lot of money on my Escort, on my Ford Escort, which is the car I had the longest. Ended up giving that one to Victory Auto Wreckers. Good old Escort. Let me tell you something, Dan. Chick magnet. If you want to get a lot of chicks, get yourself an 86 Ford Escort. That'll do it for you. Oh, that was a tone. That means we have to go to the news, which is up next. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 lovely stories above downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. And my main man, Steve Cochran, has your morning drive at 6 here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We've been talking about things that are turning 50 this year, making us feel old, and we're reminiscing about some really cool stuff. And, yeah, we're here till 5 o'clock doing that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. How about this? The Star Trek finale is 50 years old. Wow. Given its pop culture dominance and impact on the science fiction genre, it's hard to believe that the original version of Star Trek only spent 3 seasons on the air. But on June 3rd, 1969, early Trekkies watched as an evil scientist swapped bodies with Captain Kirk and attempted to take control of the Enterprise in the series finale, Turnabout Intruder. It really is... You know, you think about it, Dan, it really is crazy that show was only on for 3 seasons.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was, I mean, it's funny because, you know, it was supposed to be a 5-year mission. That's what the intro says every show, but they got canceled after 3. But, you know, all the spin-offs and all the whole, you know, and then, of course, the movies. I remember when the first movie came out. First movie, I was in high school. I was a freshman in high school, saw it at the Norridge, where I was. We went to the Norridge just this past weekend. Saw that damn dog movie that made me cry. My mom's like, I really want to see that movie, and I'm like, all right, you know, because obviously, you know, it's my mom, and you know, and I want her to be happy, you know, so I'll sit through a stupid dog movie just so my mom is happy. And then I ended up crying at the end of the damn thing. I mean, come on, you know? I mean, it's a dog movie. You know what I'm talking about, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, there are very few dog movies that don't make you cry.
And if at one point the dog gets hurt, you know, and he's like limping around. He's got one paw up. Come on, man. I can't watch that. I can't expect it to be watching that with no response emotionally. What the hell's the name of the movie? Dog Went Home? It's the dog's way home. The house, the dog goes home. What is a damn dog movie that's out right now?
A Dog's Way Home.
A Dog's Way Home. All right. Anyway, we saw that at the Norwich. But anyway, the first Star Trek movie. Dan, have you seen the first Star Trek movie?
I have not.
Star Trek the Motion Picture came out in 1979, and I remember there was a huge line at the Norwich when it first opened. All geeks, you know, just very, very excited. And there's a very quiet theater afterwards. People were like, oh, man. Because the first Star Trek movie stinks. It's terrible. And it's like 9 hours long. But then all was forgiven because of Wrath of Khan. Wrath of Khan rules the planet. Now, I was never a Star Trek guy. I never, you know, I never watched it. You know, I never got into it, not when I was a kid or anything. I never got into it. But and then when I saw the first movie, I was like, ugh. But then there's that whole theory about how the even-numbered movies are the good ones. So, because the second one is Wrath of Khan, which is one of the greatest. I mean, easily the best Star Trek movie without question, and I think one of the best science fiction movies ever made, Wrath of Khan. And then the fourth one was The Voyage Home, where they go back in time to save whales. Have you seen that one, Dan?
I have not.
Have you seen any Star Trek movie?
I don't think I have.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not even Wrath of Khan? Wrath of Khan?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that movie rules. You don't have to be a Star Trek fan to enjoy Wrath of Khan. So there's that one, and then that was the fourth one. And then the sixth one, because we're going even a sixth one. I'm trying to remember what the plot of the sixth one was. Because Voyage Home was with the whales. Then it was the fifth one is the one that Shatner directed and widely considered the worst of all the Star Trek movies. The sixth one, I can't remember what the hell.
Undiscovered Country?
The Undiscovered Country, right. Does it have a plot?
Kronos Moon Praxis, which apparently is the Klingon Empire's chief energy source, is devastated by an explosion caused by overmining. The Klingons make peace overtures to the Federation. The Klingon Chancellor, while en route for the summit, is assassinated by an Enterprise crewman, and is held accountable by the Chancellor's chief of staff.
Right.
Spock attempts to prove Kirk's innocent, but in doing so, uncovers a mass conspiracy against the peace process.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's good. But yeah, the Star Trek finale, 50 years old. How about this? Mario Puzo's The Godfather. The best-selling novel, which led to Francis Ford Coppola's Oscar-winning movie, was published on March 10th, 1969. I remember when the movie came out, man. It was just such a, just a monster. 1972, it came out. So 3 years after the novel. How about this? The Concorde. Ooh. While the origins of the supersonic jet just came to be known as the Concorde back in the 50s, it wasn't until March 2nd, 1969 that the vessel made its maiden voyage. It would be another 7 years for the plane to become a regular sight in the skies. You know what I think of every time I hear I hear the Concorde, Dan? I think of, this is going to, I'm going to have to explain, but I always think of Phil Collins.
Sure.
Do you know why?
I think I have an idea.
Because of Live Aid. Because of Live Aid.
I am wrong.
What did you think?
Who was it that, like, managed to perform on seven continents in seven days?
Oh, yeah. I don't know who that was. But I tell you, but the reason why I thought of it, Dan, is because Phil Collins, they made a big deal. Because, you know, Live Aid was in two places. It was at Wembley Stadium in London, and it was also in Philadelphia. So they had two of it going simultaneously. Phil Collins played both venues because of the Concorde. So he took the Concorde from, I think he started in London, and then he ended up in Philadelphia, and everybody made a big deal out of it. Ooh, Phil Collins played both venues at Live Aid. Nobody else did that, and it's because of the Concorde. So, and I'm not kidding. Whenever I read about the Concorde or I hear about the Concorde, first thing that pops into my head is Phil Collins and how he played both venues at at Live Aid. Oh. How about that? Paul Rudd turns 50. Hollywood's most likable actor was born. He's Hollywood's most likable actor. I mean, look, I like Paul, but is he really Hollywood's most likable actor? He's very likable. He was born in New Jersey on April 6, 1969. Rudd shares a birthday with Matthew McConaughey and Dave Bautista. Wait, McConaughey turns 50 this year? Wow. And Dave Bautista?
Yes.
Okay. And you know, what's really funny is that, you know, Jennifer Aniston obviously turns 50 this year, and so does Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd's been on Friends a bunch of times, right? Was he a semi-regular?
Yes. Yeah, he was dating Phoebe.
And he was dating Phoebe. Oh, good for him. but the other thing that we mentioned, you know how we mentioned Jennifer Aniston was in Mac and Me. Every time Paul Rudd is on, you know this, right? Every time Paul Rudd is on Conan O'Brien's show.
Oh, yeah.
whatever movie he's promoting, they always show the same clip from Mac and Me with the kid in the wheelchair. And it's never not funny. Every single time, and it's always the same clip from Mac and Me. They eventually do show the real clip, you know, that Paul Rudd is promoting. But the first clip that they always show is that every time Paul Rudd is on Conan O'Brien's show, they show that clip from Mac and Me. No idea, though, that Jennifer Aniston was in Mac and Me. How about this? The human eye transplant on April 22nd, 1969, doctors at Houston's Methodist Hospital made history when they performed the first human eye transplant on 55-year-old John Madden. While the transplant itself was technically a success, the donated eye had not been properly preserved, so Madden's eyesight remained unchanged. I don't know what they expected, Madden's wife said at the time. They tell us that being able to transplant an eye and have movement in it is really something. There you go. Lots more stuff turning 50 this year. 312-981-7200 if you would like to join us, talk or text. 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke in a little bit because it's a jokey time. We do that every Monday morning. And we would love to hear from you if you want to jump in. We're talking about things that are turning 50 this year. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 if you want to comment on any of this stuff. How about this? Midnight Cowboy. John Schlesinger's buddy dramedy about a goofy Texan played by John Voight and a sickly, albeit crafty, con man played by Dustin Hoffman teaming up to turn a six-gallon hat-wearing galoot into one of New York City's most in-demand gigolos is the first and only X-rated film to win the Oscar for Best Picture. Yeah. You know, it's funny, that movie was rated X in 1969. If you watch it now, nowadays, it's barely a PG-13. You know what I mean? But maybe pushes the R category, but it's barely, you know, I mean. But yeah, I remember that fact is the only X-rated movie to ever win the Academy Award. And the role that John Voight played was offered to Elvis. And the colonel told Elvis not to take it. So we didn't. I've said this before. I think that would have changed the course of his career if he had taken that role. And I think he would have been good. I think Elvis would have been good in that role. But, you know, as it is, it's a classic movie anyway. And, of course, you know, the "I'm walking here," that was improvised because that was a cab that almost actually hit Hoffman when they were crossing the street. And that was not supposed to happen. How about this? Quartz watches. On December 25th, 1969, following 10 years of extensive research, Seiko debuted the Quartz Astron 35SQ, the world's first quartz watch. Even today, it's still logged as one of the great milestones in electric engineering. Cool. We'll go back to the Beatles again. Abbey Road, 50 years old. The Beatles' 11th studio album, the final one on which all four original members recorded together, was released on September 26, 1969. Let It Be came out on May 8, 1970, but it was recorded before Abbey Road. So technically Abbey Road was the last album that they recorded, was their last album, but Let It Be came out after. Home surveillance systems are 50 years old. On December 2nd, 1969, Queens, New York native Marie V.B. Brown and her husband Albert were issued a patent for a home security system that allowed the owner to utilize the television set in order to see and hear whoever was at the front door. Wow. Portnoy's Complaint is 50 years old. On January 12, 1969, the publication of Portnoy's Complaint turned author Philip Roth into an instant celebrity and a lightning rod for controversy for those who took issue with his frank depictions of sexuality. Yeah. The Saturday Evening Post's final issue After nearly 150 years of Norman Rockwell covers and iconic Americana, the Saturday Evening Post ceased publication in 1969, though the print magazine was revived in 1971. Its focus was more on medical articles, so it was never again the same thing that it always, that it had been. Wow. Wes Anderson turns 50 this year. The quirky, whimsy-loving director. He does love whimsy, doesn't he? The quirky, whimsy-loving director behind Bottle Rocket, the Royal Tenenbaums, and the Grand Budapest Hotel was born in Houston, Texas on May 1st, 1969. How about that? He turns 50 in May. You know, I think a lot of people have a, you know, have a limit when it comes to Wes Anderson. I know that that Eric has reached his limit. Are you one of those people that has that just tires of Wes Anderson?
I don't seek him out enough to be tired of him, but I am selective of my choices. So it's like I've only seen a couple of his movies, so yeah. I have not grown tired of it. But I could see someone who's seen a lot of it being like, all right,
see. What's weird is I'm not tired of Wes Anderson. I love his stuff. And, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the whole whimsy, you know, whimsy loving director. Yeah, clearly. But I'm not tired. I never grow tired. I thought Isle Dogs was great. And I mean, I like his stuff, you know. I like all his movies. I really do. And I think the last one that I really, really, really loved was Moonrise Kingdom. I think that was the one that really, the kids in that movie were so great. And I don't know, but I can understand why people, you know, it's the same thing over and over again. You know, what you're going to get when you see a Wes Anderson movie, you know what you're going to get. And I like that. But, Eric had it, but about five movies ago, I think he was done with him. Because like five films ago. But you know, I mean, you know, when Wes Anderson makes a movie, you know that Bill Murray's going to be in it. So that, right, that's a good thing, right? So my friend David Cromer, Tony Award winning friend David Cromer, is in a play right now called Waverly. He's on Broadway right now in a play. He's also an actor. And he's in a play with Lucas Hedges and Elaine May, for God's sake. He gets to act with Elaine May. Waverly Place is the name of the play, and he's in New York. He's in it. I think it runs through the end of January. He posted on his Facebook page that Bill Murray came to see the play. Bill Murray came to see the play, and then he was backstage afterwards. And he was walking past Bill Murray, and because David's in the show, he's walking past Bill Murray, and Bill Murray just acknowledged him because he was in the show, acknowledged him, and said, "Hey, that was it." And David was like, "It was the greatest moment of my life." They didn't have any kind of exchange or anything. He didn't introduce himself or anything like that. He recognized him. He was in the play, and then Bill Murray just kind of like did him a head nod and said, "Hey," and like David was like, "This is the greatest moment of my life." He didn't say it was better than winning a Tony, but I think it was close. I think being acknowledged by Bill Murray is a pretty special thing. I got to meet Bill Murray twice, and one time he was a jerk, and one time he was great. Because anybody who's ever like had encounters with Bill Murray say that there are two types of Bill Murray. You know what I mean? You're gonna get the greatest, the coolest dude in the world, or you're gonna get a jerk. That's usually. But yeah. Oh, hey, speaking of Bill Murray, hey, you know, I'm hosting a screening of Barefoot in the Park. I don't know if you know that or not, Dan.
I had heard that on the radio.
It'll be on February 5th, Tuesday night, February 5th. One of my favorite comedies, my mom's favorite movie of all time, Robert Redford, Jane Fonda, really beautifully funny movie. We're doing it for Valentine's Day. It'll be at 8 o'clock at the AMC Rosemont 18. You can see Barefoot in the Park on the big screen. Seriously, Robert Redford, one of my favorite comedic performances of all time. Robert Redford is hilarious in Barefoot in the Park. It's only $10. Parking is free. And speaking of Bill Murray, the guys over at Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant right down the street are doing a special for us. 15% off your food items again. And because it's a Valentine's Day celebration, because it's a romantic comedy in February, they're going to be doing some Valentine's Day specials, drink specials and dessert specials, all part of it. So like 6 o'clock, everybody can come on in to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant, just a couple of blocks away from the movie theater. Go before the movie, have some dinner. The food is really good, and they've got a full bar. And again, they're going to have specials for couples and for Valentine's Day, with Valentine's Day desserts and drinks, special stuff like that. And 15% off all your food items. We've been partnering up with these guys now. This will be the third time we've done this, and it's great. You know, we got a nice big crowd. Everybody has a lot of fun food, and then we walk over to the theater or drive over to the theater, and then I'll introduce the movie. So it's Barefoot in the Park. It's Tuesday, February 5th at the AMC Rosemont 18. $10 parking is free. Beforehand, just go down the block to the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant, have some food. It's 15% off all food. There'll be, like I said, there's going to be Valentine's Day specials, drinks and desserts. So you can reserve your seats now for the movie, available right now. And you can go to amctheaters.com, amctheaters.com. Go to the Barefoot in the Park screening page and pick out the seats that you want. Go to the seating chart, pick them out, and they'll be waiting for you when you show up. Again, it's Tuesday, February 5th at the AMC Rosemont. Parking is free, $10 to get in, and then have some dinner beforehand, some food and some drinks, some Valentine's Day specials over at the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant right down the street. So that's all coming up again on Tuesday, February 5th, Tuesday, February 5th, Barefoot in the Park on the big screen. Hope you guys can make it. All right, let's take a break. We've got the news coming up after this. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m., my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning and that's what we do here. And it's a jokey time. That's coming up. And yeah. And then Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive on this Monday morning. Welcome back, everybody. We've been talking about things that turn 50 this year and reminiscing about a bunch of stuff and then basically feeling a little old, too. Capri Sun turns 50. That seems weird, doesn't it, Dan? That Capri Sun has been around for 50 years?
That one I could kind of see.
Really?
Yeah.
Though Capri Sun, and it's notoriously difficult to pierce in just the right juice pouches, didn't make it to the U.S. until 1981. The juice concentrate was first introduced in Switzerland in 1969. Okay. Because I always thought Capri Sun was an 80s thing. Do you kids drink the Capri Sun?
They have on occasion. It's like 100% real juice now.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. So they're allowed to have that. But it's not as common as some of the other juices we give them. So.
Yeah. Now, how do you navigate that kind of stuff? Do you have to look at labels, right?
Costco, we are Costco members and we shop a lot of Costco, and they go out of their way to make sure that a lot of that stuff is 100% juice or 100% whatever. So we just kind of, when we're buying such things, we go there, but we don't buy much juice anyway. So,
yeah. Because that's just because some of those juices are just nothing but sugar.
It's just, I can't. Yeah. No, I mean, if we're at a party or something and that's all they have, we'll let them have it. But if we're buying it,
No. Yeah. Okay. Do they get all hopped up on Go Juice when they have a little sugar in them?
Yes, they do.
All right. 50 years old. Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin's first studio album made its American debut January 12, 1969, less than a year after the iconic rock band's formation. You know, the first Zeppelin album was recorded and mixed in 2 days, something along those lines. Like it was recorded, I think it was recorded like in 8 hours or something. And then it was put together and it was done. I mean, they did it like 2 days. They did it. The first Zeppelin album. The second Zeppelin album came out the same year. That's also 50 years old. Zeppelin II, oddly enough, because it's the second Zeppelin album and it's called Zeppelin II. That's my favorite Zeppelin album of all time. That came out less than a year. I think it was like 6 or 7 months after the first album came out. And when Zeppelin II came out, they were on that was recorded. That album was recorded while they were on tour. That's got a whole lot of love on it. That's probably the most popular song on that. But it's 50 years old, Led Zeppelin. I got to see him twice. I was very lucky. Well, I mean, I was lucky to see him in 75, not so much as 77, because they were completely loaded when they came out. You know, John Paul Jones was the only sober person on that stage when they came out, and then they were, because normally, you know, Robert Plant would come out and bring a bottle of Jack on stage with him, and he'd crack the seal at the top of the show, you know, and he would drink Jack Daniels. He would chug Jack Daniels during the course of the show. And Zeppelin always played for well over 2 hours. They played for like 2.5 hours most of the time. So this night they come out, and the Jack Daniels bottle is halfway empty. The seal had been broken already, and they weren't even on stage yet. Page was so loaded, he spent most of the show sitting on a folding chair. And you could just tell John Paul Jones is on stage going, oh, man, because John Bonham was drunk all the time. That's what killed him. The guy drank like 5 bottles of vodka the night he died. But yeah, John Paul Jones, you could just tell, you know, he's up there going, oh, God, these guys. And then I did have tickets for the 1980 tour that was canceled because John Bonham died. But I did have tickets for that. I still have those. I still have my tickets at home, I think, for that. But yeah, 50 years ago, the first Zeppelin album. In the 70s, there was nobody bigger. There was not a band on the planet that was bigger than Led Zeppelin in the 70s. And for good reason. All right, how about this? Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That turns 50. Director George Roy Hill took the American Western to dizzying new heights with the help of Paul Newman and Robert Redford when Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was released in theaters on October 24th. 1969, and 4 Oscars followed. George Roy Hill would go on to direct Slapshot, which I showed a couple of weeks ago, or last week. It was last week? Last Tuesday, yeah. He would go on to, he also did The Sting. George Roy Hill worked with Paul Newman several times, Paul Newman and Robert Redford. How about this? RMS Queen Elizabeth II. For nearly 40 years, the RMS Queen Elizabeth II was the Grand Dame of the Atlantic Ocean. As part of the Cunard family of ships, the luxury ocean liner made her maiden voyage on May 2nd, 1969, and continued to serve as a transatlantic shuttle between Southampton, England, and New York City until 2008. In 2018, she reopened as a floating hotel in Dubai. Oh, is that right? That's pretty cool. You know, I've never been on a cruise. Dan, have you ever gone on a cruise?
I have never been on a cruise.
Interested ever?
Probably not.
Yeah.
I walked by an advertisement just like yesterday where it said, you know, you are not a tourist and this is not a cruise. And that kind of intrigued me. And like, I know people who love it.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just all they do.
My parents went on a cruise and could not stop talking about how great it was.
But
this is a long time ago. Yeah. But I can't. It's you know. Now, granted, you know it's going to dock, and you will.
Right.
You know, you do have a destination.
Right.
But like, I don't know, spending all that time on a boat.
Right.
You know, I'm not good with boats either. I mean, it's obviously these things are massive and they don't feel like a boat at all.
Right,
you
right.
know, there's like there's cities inside some of these right. things, like 5 different pools and casinos and restaurants and all right. kinds of stuff. So it doesn't feel, you know, like a boat. But I don't know, just being there, just in that,
yeah,
on that boat, I'm sure that there's a ton of stuff more than shuffleboard that you can do. I know that, yeah. I know that there's a lot of things that you can do. My parents went on this cruise like 20 something years ago, and they loved it. They absolutely loved it. They said there was plenty of stuff to do. You know, I can't remember where they went or where it boarded or where it docked. But yeah, and I'm not a real big boat guy.
Despite the fact you own that 75-foot yacht that we don't, you know, in the Lake Michigan.
Yes, yeah. I own the Odyssey right out here. That's mine.
Dinner cruises are fine. It's those long form cruises.
It's the long ones, yeah. The dinner cruises are fine. Lake Michigan dinner cruise, that's fine. I think this is the Odyssey is pretty cool because it's right outside the window here.
Yeah,
it's docked right outside the window. I can look over here and just see it. And the name is all lit up all night long. They never turn it off. Sometimes it changes color. Just says Odyssey. You know.
Did I ever tell you my Odyssey story?
No.
So Eileen and I had just gotten married, and we're just gotten engaged.
Okay.
And so, you know, the waiter's making his way, you know, through the tables, and
you're on the Odyssey.
We're on the Odyssey.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, are you guys celebrating anything special? I'm like, no. And she's just like, we just got engaged. She was like, oh, crap. And so, sure enough, you know, four or five songs into the DJ set, he's just like, oh, we got a special announcement, everybody.
Man.
And so he's like, we'd like to invite Dan and Eileen out here to celebrate their new engagement. And he's like, for you guys, I want to play this song. And he plays Al Green's Let's Stay Together. And so we're dancing to it, and then, like, you know, after the first verse, he's just like, all right, everybody, all you married people, you know, make them feel welcome to the club. Come on out here on the dance floor. Join them.
God.
Nobody.
Nobody?
Nobody. Nobody gets up. And she's just like, oh, she's like, I'm really embarrassed. I'm like, this is all on you.
It's the longest Al Green song of all time for you guys, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. You know, my buddy Chaz Verba, he's a DJ on the...
Oh, there you go. Maybe it was Chaz.
Maybe it was Chaz who did that to you. Yeah, no, he's been on... I don't know if he's on the Odyssey. I know he's on... I mean, I think he bounces from, you know, whatever cruise, you know, nighttime cruise ships are out there. But he's been doing that for a long time, so I'm sure that he's had to do that. Hey, everybody, come on out on the dance floor. That's hilarious that nobody even came out. So is it just a room full of people staring at you guys?
Pretty much.
Other than that, did you enjoy the Odyssey?
It was a lovely time otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, it's good food and, you know, nice sights and everything.
Yeah. I've done it a couple times. I've gone out on the boats a couple of times, and that's fun. It's, you know, for a few hours you're out there. Food is generally good and everything. So that's funny, though. And we just got engaged. All right. We got to take a break here, and we'll wrap up the 50-year-old stuff here. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. After my dad calls in and tells a joke, which will be happening after we break, which is happening after we do the weather, which is happening now.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yeah, that's right, that's right. It's, you know that theme. That's when my dad calls in every Monday morning and tells a joke. And we're going to get to that in a second. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. Let's say hello to my dad. Good morning, Dad.
Hey, Nick.
How are you?
Good.
How's Ma?
Real good.
All right.
Yeah, we got our cruise was in 1987.
Oh, God. It was that long ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
We got a 45-minute tape of everything we got. you know, we did on the cruise. I told jokes in front of 3,000 people.
Right, I know you got up on stage and then the band made fun of you.
Yeah, they did. They kind of passed out after they opened the curtain.
Yeah, they act like they were passed out. I'm sure they did that to everybody. So
right,
that was
a lot of fun.
Yeah,
we were Sonny and Cher lip sync contest. I got you, babe.
Yeah. So that was a long time ago. Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
So my joke.
Yeah.
My joke is my electrician partner accidentally blew the power to the ice cube factory. The company had now gone into liquidation.
Oh, wait a minute. Hold it. Somebody messed with the thing here. Hold on a second. Hold on. Wait a minute. Hold on. Okay. All right. I had to get the rim shot from someplace else, Dad. All right. Good job, Dad.
All right, Nick.
See you later. There you go.
Okay, bye.
See ya. There's my dad telling a joke. What happened now? Hold on a second. This thing is right. Oh, see, there's the problem. Here we go. There it is. I'm going to mess around with my board, man. You want to hit the thing?
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do it again next Monday as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're wrapping up talking about things that turn 50 this year. We had Woodstock turn 50 this year, and the Altamont Free Concert turned 50. And, yeah, that didn't turn out the way it was supposed to turn out, to say the least. If you've never seen the movie Gimme Shelter, it's an astonishing piece of work, and what happened was just incredible. While it's often reported that the Hell's Angels were officially hired as security for this event, some individuals involved in its planning deny this. But there's no denying that several members of the infamous Motorcycle Club were indeed there, surrounding the stage and reacting to the increasingly agitated crowd. By the end of the night, four people had been killed, three of them accidentally, while many more were injured due to scuffles of varying degrees of severity. The documentarians Albert and David Mazels were on hand to record the events, which they turned into Gimme Shelter, one of the most fascinating rockumentaries of all time. It's a terrifying movie. It really is. It's unbelievable what happened and how they captured it. And that's not even what, you know, that basically wasn't even, you know, obviously all that stuff happened while they just happened to be there. They just happened to be lucky enough, quote unquote, not necessarily lucky enough, but like a lot of documentary filmmakers, you know, you're there to document something and then something different happens and you get to record it. And as a result, they've made one of the most, fascinating and compelling documentaries of all time. How about this one? The battery-operated smoke detector turns 50. Dwayne D. Pearsall invented the first battery-operated smoke detector on February 5th, 1969. The Manson family. In 1967, following his release from a seven-year prison stint for forging checks and transporting women across state lines for the purpose of prostitution, Charles Manson moved to San Francisco and began assembling a devout group of followers, among them many young women, who were ready to do his bidding, whatever that might be. Though the family unit was formed a bit earlier, they rose to global prominence, much to the horror of everyday citizens everywhere, when a group of Manson followers murdered five people at Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate's Los Angeles rental home on the evening of August 8, 1969. Tate, who was 8 months pregnant at the time, was among the victims. 1 week later, police raided Spawn Ranch, where the Manson family lived, and arrested 26 individuals, Manson among them. I remember the book Helter Skelter was so hugely popular in the 70s. I know my mom had a copy of it, and I ended up reading it later. But then the TV movie. And the TV movie freaked me out. Like, it was, I was totally, I mean, the whole story is, you know, obviously, you know, tragic and sad and scary, but it was just something that at my age at that time when the book became really popular, and when the TV movie was made, the miniseries, I was probably 11 or 12, and it totally freaked me out. It was a true story, and you could see pictures of this guy, this Charles Manson guy, and Steve Railsback played him in the movie. And I just remember really, really being freaked out by it. Even though I'd seen like 9,000 horror movies, it was just something about the fact that it was real and it really happened and that this guy's a real guy. Totally freaked me out. Yeah. And the miniseries, I guess, was like a huge like ratings, you know, bonanza. Like everybody watched it. And the book was a huge bestseller. So that's 50 years old. The Manson family. Oh, here you go. Scooby-Doo is 50. Scooby-Doo is as old as Jennifer Aniston. On September 13th, 1969, CBS viewers were introduced to the kind of trippy world of Scooby-Doo and his gang of human mystery solvers when Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Debuted as part of the Saturday morning cartoon lineup. That most of the mysteries ended in the same way, with the gang pulling a mask off of the monster who had been stalking them, only to find out it was a human that they knew. It didn't seem to hinder the classic cartoon's popularity. Yeah, every episode was exactly the same. Except then they brought in Scrappy-Doo. That was like the, you know, that was like the Cousin Oliver of cartoons. They brought in Scrappy-Doo. That's when it jumped the shark. Dan, did you get into Scooby-Doo when you were young?
Nah, you know, it was something that was always on, but just never latched onto.
Yeah. I was, you know, this was right in my wheelhouse when it, you know what I mean? When it started, I mean, I was four when it debuted. And you know, there were mysteries and ghosts and stuff.
Right.
And so I loved it. I watched Scooby-Doo all the time. And then until Scrappy-Doo came in, and then it was just like, no, let's throw the TV out the window. Scrappy-Doo. And then finally, Turn-On. Several months before Monty Python's Flying Circus made its debut, another sketch comedy show, one that included Albert Brooks among its writers, made its premiere on February 5th, 1969, and disappeared just as quickly. Though two episodes were filmed, only one aired, leaving the series to be remembered as one of the biggest flops of all time. Turn-On. Now, I don't remember. I mean, I know that it was a show that obviously failed. But I didn't know that Albert Brooks was a writer. That means I have to go back and watch the one episode. Turn-On. All right, those things turned 50 this year. So there you go. All righty then. We got a break here. We got the news coming up next. Tomorrow, Beverly Gray is going to join us. Right, author
yep.
Beverly Gray. She's written several books, and she writes about movies, and she's been in the business, worked for Roger Corman for many years, and wrote a terrific book about her time working for the great Roger Corman. And we love to have Beverly on just to talk movies and chat and catch up with her. So Beverly Gray is going to be with us tomorrow. So we're going to take a break here, and the news is coming up after this.